This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
There are over 550 million firearms in worldwide circulation. That's one firearm for every 12 people on the planet. The only question is, how do we arm the other 11?
Selling guns is like selling vacuum cleaners. You make calls, pound the pavement. I supplied every army but the Salvation Army.
Can you bring me the gun of Rambo?
Part one, two, or three?
I've only seen part one.
Of all the weapons in the vast Soviet arsenal, nothing was more profitable than Avtomat Kalashnikova, model of 1947, more commonly known as the AK-47 or Kalashnikov. It's the world's most popular assault rifle, a weapon all fighters love. An elegantly simple 9-pound amalgamation of forged steel and plywood. It doesn't break, jam, or overheat. It will shoot whether it's covered in mud or filled with sand. It's so easy, even a child can use it, and they do. The Soviets put the gun on a coin. Mozambique put it on their flag. Since the end of the Cold War, the Kalashnikov has become the Russian people's greatest export. After that comes vodka, caviar, and suicidal novelists. One thing's for sure, no one was lining up to buy their cars.
It is 24 minutes after the hour of one in this, the month of Geektober, in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. Live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, America's new home for whimsy and occasionally threats, but mostly whimsy. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us on this fine Tuesday. It is 503-505-6964, if you want, you should get with the talking and the speechifying and the bumping of the gums and so forth. It's 503-505-6964 if you'd like to weigh in with your comments, questions, clarifications, combinations of the above things, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature, whatever it is you might have. 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached at Don, that is D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com. And as of this very moment, my chums, my amigos, mi compadres, my fellow travelers on the road of amusement and whimsy, you can also join us at the text box, which is at rickemerson.com. You just go to live chat, and you will be able to chat, you know, live and stuff. So there you go. It's the Rick Emerson radio program brought to you by The Cleaning Solution. Mr. Michael Beatty owns and operates that business and does so flawlessly. And by flawlessly, I mean that he chooses to ally with us in a business sense. And that really is, I mean, everything else is just gravy after that. I mean, that's really the crucial thing, really, is how it affects me, Rick Emerson. 971-533-3211 is how you can contact him. And we'll have more information on him later on in the program. Speaking of later on in the program, we will be talking with Mr. Eric D. Snyder. He'll be in the studio with us. We also have a corpse watch coming up today. Taser watch coming up today. We'll be doing a top five. See if I got this right. So these are the top five films, top five songs based on a horror film that also mention the title of the film in the title of the song.
Right.
All right.
I started out with top five songs that were based on horror movies. And when I discovered that there were so many.
There were 7,000 of them.
A gazillion of them. I decided to limit myself to songs that the title of the song is actually the title of a film.
All right. So these are the top five songs based on a horror film, which actually echo the title of said film. All right. So that's coming up later on the day. We'll do that top five. Also, another installment of Pop Culture Authority, making you more intelligent in the most useless way possible, one show at a time. Today's Pop Culture Authority answers this question. Pop Culture Authority answers the question, is John Lennon actually singing the phrase, I don't want to hold your hand, in the Beatles song, I Want to Hold Your Hand? Is John Lennon actually singing, I don't want to hold your hand? You'll find out the answer to that and other things. Later on in this broadcast, Don Taylor's tracking the following stories for you on this Tuesday.
Oregon is suing the University of Phoenix.
Hooray, I guess.
Folks are giving less money to churches. And scientists say there are no unicorns.
Okay. That's all coming up, as well as a corpse watch, a taser watch, and a myriad other observations of an amusing nature. It's 503-505-6964. Because we didn't get a chance to do this yesterday. We sort of ran out of time. Did you ever go look at the video that listener Andy sent us of the Geeko Lantern?
Damn it, I forgot. No,
it's just unreal. If you actually go to rickemerson.com/pictures. If you go to rickemerson.com/pictures, you'll actually see that. It's in the visual aids. I'm sorry, not in the visual aids section. It's in the Geeko Lantern section. And you look at that photograph, of the Death Star, and you look at the photo. There's the Yoda, and then there's the one. The listener actually submitted a Geeko Lantern into which is carved her representation of your femur, while it was apparently still intact. Have you not seen that?
No! I've missed everything good. Oh, my God.
Good God, woman. What do you do with your time?
You
go there right now. You check it out. So we've got the first submission, which is me as Kim Jong-il / Stalin. Somebody has carved... I can't believe that you didn't realize it or that nobody mentioned it to you.
No.
You go to rickemerson.com/pictures. Look at the Geeko Lantern section. Like the second submission we got. Her name escapes me at the moment, and I apologize. I don't have it in front of me.
Look at that, Melody.
Melody.
It's my leg bone.
So she carved an image of what she believed your leg bone would look like. She carved that into a pumpkin and sent that in as her Geeko Lantern submission.
And splattered it with blood and gore of some sort.
Well, it is Halloween, and you are Dawn Taylor. So... how awesome is that?
My leg bone has been immortalized.
Listener Todd sent a couple of his own submissions, and I think at least one of those is actually a thing. He was actually very upfront about this. It's a thing he carved last year, but he felt that he just sort of, what you said, I will remove myself from contention for the Think Geek Prize, as he said, because the Death Star, was something I carved last year, but he wanted to send it along. And then listener Andy just ups the ante by sending us this, like a 2-minute video of this fully functioning Linux machine that he has made that I think resides inside a pumpkin. And if you watch the video, there's a whole narration where he actually says, and now I'm turning on the pumpkin, and you will actually see the high-resolution display as it emerges on this monitor. It's pretty fantastic. So you can see that at rickemerson.com/pictures.
I'm going to eat chocolate while I look at this.
Okay. So that may take a second to load, but that's at rickemerson.com/pictures. And don't forget, all the way through next Monday, that is up until 11:59 p.m. on Monday, the 25th of this month, you can submit your Geeko Lantern pictures. Somebody actually asked, I got an email just before we went on the air today, a guy said, are we responsible for keeping the jack-o'-lantern around? Like he said, there's a rotting issue that starts to be relevant. Mm-hmm. He said, do I have to keep it around? And initially we had said, well, you got to be able to bring it into the studio, A, because we want to see it, and also because, so we know you didn't just... just download some crap off the internet. But also, you got to figure that, of all the audiences that are going to be above board about this, this audience would be, the most likely to, our audience doesn't traffic in lies. Also, they got people, they got a guy listening to us in, Rotterdam or something yesterday. So, no, you just send us a photograph. If you're able, you get a shot of you carving the thing, and then that, that handles any whatever that might come up later on. But you just send us the photo. We're going to stick it up there. You got about, 6 days left to do that. Up for grabs, whole pile of things from ThinkGeek.com, including a $100 gift certificate. A $100 gift certificate.
That, so that is, computer inside the jack-o'-lantern is about the geekiest thing I've ever seen.
Awesome. And to the folks who were on Facebook yesterday, because I posted this before the show, I said, hey, look at this cool thing that Andy made. And it's like every other message, it was just some guy going like, I'm a failure. I'm going to go home and destroy the thing that I was carving. Because it was, it was like some guy at home and he was, he was like he was carving like an Ewok or something, and then, you know, he just decided that he could not possibly measure up, and he was just, I'm going to go home and destroy this moon of Endor that I'm creating. It's a shame. But the thing is, there are myriad prizes. We got the four prizes.
We have at least six prizes. Well, no, at least five prizes.
Well, we got at least five. We got the five prizes from ThinkGeek.com, and then we got the $100 gift certificate. So,
and we still have bugles lying around, and we have things we could send people.
And also, Don Taylor, it's just plain fun.
It is.
So, I mean, really, be about the journey, kids, not about the destination.
Yeah.
So, you know, carve for carving's sake, won't you please?
Yeah.
You just be a carving. Be George Washington Carver. Just, sort of, you know, and then, you know, send that on in. So you send that to contest@rickemerson.com. That is contest@rickemerson.com. So one more time, coming up today, Pop Culture Authority, we answer the question, is John Lennon really saying the phrase, I don't want to hold your hand? Corpse Watch, Taser Watch, Mr. Eric D. Snyder will be in the studio, and we'll do the top five songs based on a horror film. That is the top five songs based on a horror film. And so now we, I think, have finally returned to some state of equilibrium on the program. It's been a bit of a day here. So I'm, I should say this first and foremost, and I mean this the utmost sincerity. I'm really not grumpy. I'm not grumpy. I'm not cranky. But it's one of those days where my mood, where like, if you had to pick it out of a lineup, it could be confused with grumpiness. You know, it's just one of those things where if you had to take the Pepsi challenge on it, I don't necessarily know. Sometimes I have different moods that at first blush will appear to be, you know, something they're not. They look similar to one another. So here's what happened today. I'm just going to work backward. So just now, as we were starting the, you know, getting ready to do the show, I was, you know, scrambling to get some last-minute things done because we got put behind early on. We got put behind early on because we had some technical difficulties at the beginning of Legion News where we were like 5 minutes late getting on the air because we couldn't figure out. We were having difficulty getting the audio from here to Cascadia.fm.
See, and then, now you're not working backwards at all. Now you've leapt to the beginning.
No, I'm working backward from here to there.
Okay.
So we were, you know, late getting on the air because we were unable to get the, you know, the audio from, you know, from here to Cascadia.fm. That followed a news prep period of about 15 or 20 minutes before we tried to go on the air with Legion of News, in which it smelled for all the world as though the building were on fire. The building we were broadcasting, there's that certain kind of, you know, that hot, kind of dusty, dry, sort of like you got a space heater or a toaster oven or something that maybe you got it at a Goodwill for $1.99 and it's just been sitting there running in the basement for 3 years, and the cord has finally decided just to go up in flames. And so it smelled for all the world like there was some sort of a fire happening here in the studio. This was then exacerbated by the fact that suddenly, like without warning, it went from being room temperature in this studio where we do the show, like 75 degrees or whatever, to like 95 degrees in the space of like 4 minutes. And so Don and I are just sweating like pigs. Also, it smells like fire and death. Also, we can't get the audio to work. You know, and so it was just busy. I'm trying not to have a mental breakdown where we're doing a Legion of News.
I say something to you at one point, and you're like, don't talk to me! I'm looking at this thing! And you've got, like, cables in both hands, and you're looking at dangling plugs that aren't attached to anything, and with this wild look in your eye, like you would just like to find someone and hurt them.
You just look pretty, Dawn. I'm going to make things work over here. So that was like, just between, like, 11:50 and 1 p.m. That was an hour and 10 minutes. Between 11:30 and 11:45, when I got here, because I got up early and I was in the glorious Beaverton, taping an episode of Outlook Portland, and man, I was so proud of him. I got out of there at like 10:30. I got everything done. I got all my commercials taped. I got my wraparound stuff taped. I was changed. I took off my stupid my getup, my garb, my suit. It was changed back into my regular clothes. I was in the car. I drove back to Portland, and I thought, by God, I'm going to stop and I'm going to get myself a visa. Then I got stuck in construction. There's that place halfway between Beaverton and here where you pass. It's like Sunset Memorial Home or whatever. It's like a funeral home you pass. It was right around there. It's just that where you see the creeping horror over the horizon, where you can't quite tell why traffic has stopped, you know, or when it's going to get better. You just see that there's a line of cars snaking off to, like, you know, infinity. Where nobody is moving. People use that word gridlock a lot, but gridlock actually has a very specific meaning. Gridlock is just when the light is green or, you know, there's no stop light. In other words, there's nothing actually legally impeding the flow of traffic. Yeah. You could be going, you're just not. And you're just sort of sitting there. And at one point, I see the line of cars just sort of banking off to the right out of sight, and it's still not moving. And it's that thing, it was so bad where people were actually turning off their cars. And, they, and that's when you just, and you kind of clench your teeth a little bit.
And this is Portland. So unlike most major metropolitan areas where you can get off the freeway and take surface streets to where you're going, this is the Portland metro area.
You're not going anywhere.
And you can't do that.
No, you're not getting off at Jack. You're just sitting there until they open the one tiny, tiny road through which you must all go. And it just starts to feel like some bridge on the River Kwai thing, where it's like there's just like it all narrows to one bottleneck that you got to get through, like you're Napoleon or something. Not Napoleon, Hannibal. Like you're Hannibal on an elephant and he's doing that thing on the cliff. Anyway, or Serpentor, you know, for my peeps out there. Anyway, so then the traffic is, you know, it's that comfortable cushion of time, and you experience this because you live way the hell out of nowhere, where you're on your way to work and you're looking at the clock and you're really proud of yourself and you're thinking, I got 25 minutes of spare time. I'm going to be way. I could stop and have a bagel or just go to work and bask in the glory of, of my efficiency. But then as you're sitting in traffic, you just see all of that extra time just going down the drain. But then you console yourself with, okay, well, look, even if I'm stuck here for 15 minutes, it's not going to be any worse than if I was just on my normal schedule. I won't have all the extra time, but I'm not going to be late. So then finally the traffic eases up. And then, you know, then it's like getting back into town. Then I realize I don't have any Vizo here in the studio. And, you know, to make matters worse, I had to get up. You know, I was up at like 6:30 or something this morning for Outlook Portland. So it's like I'm heading dangerously into the sort of like the red caffeine withdrawal window where thoughts are going to quit happening and words are going to quit forming in my mouth if I don't get some caffeine, if I don't get some Vizo. So I think to myself, okay, all right, Emerson, let's prioritize here. Let's not panic. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, what is the longest possible? And that's when you realize you're just a junkie, because I'm starting to look at the clock and thinking, when will the cold sweat set in? When will I start to see spiders covering my body? All right, I better stop and get some. So there's Kettleman, which is not too far from here.
I know exactly where the story's going because apparently I was there about 2 minutes before you.
Jesus. So there's a place called Kettleman not too far from my studios, which is a bagelry and a very fine place staffed with wonderful people, one of whom looks exactly like the ice truck killer from Dexter, but that's not his fault. So I go in and they've got a big, glorious cooler just filled with row upon row of Vizo and all its many flavors. And I walk in, and you know there's a line, but okay, we're heading toward lunch. This is like 11:45 this morning. And keep in mind, again, just not to make everybody just listen to the woe of my life, but everybody has had a day like this. Keep in mind at this point, this is like 11:40. So I'm already thinking, okay, look, I did my prep. I got the news prepared. I got my, everything is pretty much done for today's show. But I don't want to be walking at the last moment, especially if you're here and you start to look at your watch and think, like, where's Rick? Did he oversleep? Is he not going to show up? Is there traffic? Is he dead? Whatever. So it's like 11:40, and I'm starting to get a little, you know, concerned. Like, I got to get to the studio. Like, we got people to entertain. So I walk into Kettleman. It's a lunch rush, and I'm thinking, okay, it's a lunch rush. That's fine. I'm going to get my Vizo. I'll pay. I'll be done. I'll be gone. I'll open it as soon as she starts to ring me up, because I won't actually start to consume something until they at least ring me up. And that was good. Because I'm standing in line at Kettleman, and the line is moving along just like, it's like molasses in space. Not even in January, but I mean in the cold void of the great beyond. It's not moving at all. So it's like I realize I've now gone into some sort of bagel shop equivalent of the goddamn traffic from Beaverton. There's no reason why we should be stopped. It's just nobody, we're all just standing there like we're in an REM video or something. And then finally, I just hear the woman up front at the cash register say, yeah, so I don't know when the system's going to be back up. It appears that all of our network, it's completely gone down. So it's really, we can only do cash today. And even that's taking, we have to do all the math by hand. And then I check my pocket and I realize that to my horror, I had $2 yesterday of cash in my pocket. And I normally carry cash, but I had to spend it on a thing and it was gone. So today of all days, because I try not to pay for anything with plastic if I have to. Today of all days, no cash. Of all day, of all goddamn mother effing days, I have no cash. And so I'm looking at the Vizo in my hand, and it's that thing where like Mr. Fingers are becoming Mr. Fist. And I'm squeezing the can of Vizo, and I was just having to will myself not to scream. And now it's like 45 after the hour. It's 15 till, and we got to be on the air in 15 minutes. And this is before I knew that, by the way, I would get to the studio and it would be on fire and hot and nothing would work.
Yeah.
So that was all. That payoff was still in the future. This is just like, I don't have any caffeine and apparently can't get any. So I go and I put the Vizo back in the fridge and I slam it. I walk into the car and goddamn stupid caffeine, stupid addiction, serotonin. And I get in my car and then I'm thinking to myself, okay. Let's not freak out. And now I really am just starting to get the whole, like, clenching of the steering wheel and the grinding of the teeth, because I'm having to face the prospect of doing the rest of the show with no caffeine or no Vizo, and it's like, that can't happen. So then I think, okay, well, there's an AMPM not too far from here. It's on Powell. I'll just go to there. So I duck over to the AMPM, which is like a chore and a friggin' half, by the way, because they don't take plastic most of the time. They got a cash, but they got an ATM. So it's like I go inside, I go to the ATM, goddamn mother effing stupid life, and I put my card into the ATM this morning. And look, here's the thing. I understand that those ATMs aren't free. Somebody's got to pay for those, and I don't know whether that's the store or whether the bank just does it and they take a slice of the action or how that works. But it's 2010. Could we please no longer have these ATMs that have to dial up the connection on like a 14-4 modem? Where it says, making connection, and it has the little animated icon of the energy bolt going, dun, 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 back to the beginning, dun, 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 back to the beginning, dun, and you hear it, I can't even make the noise, but you hear the dial-up modem noise, and you're thinking, like, are you effing kidding me? It's just having to dial up the bank on a telephone line before I can even put in my transaction. And so then I'm like, yes, okay, finally connected. So give me $100 now. And so it spits out the cash, and I'm like, okay, now I'm set for the rest of the week, and I can get my Vizo. So I walk over to the case to get the Vizo, which is much more expensive at AMPM than it is anywhere else. It's like $289. I mean, but, you know, like, hey, you know, whatever. Like, brother got to eat, brother got to have his caffeine. So then I walk over, and I swear to Christ, the place where there was Vizo, they've now just replaced with vitamin water. It's just row after row, because that's what everybody wants. It's just row after row of vitamin water. The Vizo is, and I don't know what's going on there. I mean, it's like, you know, some sort of dispute, or is Alex just, you know, he's moved somewhere else, or the vitamin water people made up a better deal. It's just not there. They just don't carry it. It's not that it's expensive and not the cash. It's gone, baby, gone. There's nothing there. So now it's like 10 minutes till. And the closest pantry is like on 29th, and that's not going to work. So now I'm obliged to go back to goddamn mother effing Kettleman. And so I have to go back to Kettleman, where I already know it's going to be a friggin' wait and a half because the stupid goddamn network is down, so they can't do any credit cards. But I have no choice, because otherwise I would just sit here and just go, and just drool for the rest of the day and just sound like a friggin' mongoloid. So I go back to Kettleman. And I buy the Vizo, and I'm standing in line. Stupid, goddamn, Cattlewood, stupid network, stupid life. Hate everyone. Kill. You know, it's just wait. And then so now they've decided this is more efficient somehow at Kettleman. Not only, and by the way, I love Kettleman. I really do. I'm not trying to knock them. It's not their fault. They're making the best of a bad situation. Not only now have they done this thing where they're trying to operate without the network, they've decided that instead of just operating as like a cash-only operation this morning, you know, while they're waiting for the network to get up, they're going to write down all the credit card information by hand in pen when people order. So now if somebody says, okay, I'll take a bagel and I'll take a drink and I'll take a cookie, and the woman goes, that'll be $4.89, as she says after adding it to my hand. And then the guy, she gets her credit card, and then she has to take out the carbon. And she's writing the carbon out by hand. And I'm just sitting in the back, just wishing for all the world that a fireball would hit the earth and just consume all of us in a torrent of cleansing flame. That I finally got the Vizo, got here to the studio, and as the guy says in the beginning of the Divine Comedy, it was here that my troubles truly began. Because that's when I got in here, and then there was the heat and the fire and the burning, and hey, it's 150 degrees, and oh, by the way, none of our audio works, and we actually can't get Legion of News on the air correctly. What a glorious day this is going to be. So I'm really, honestly, I swear to Christ, I'm not grumpy, but it is one of those things where I'm a little frazzled today. So it's going to be a great day, one of the best we've ever had. Amity, as you know, means friendship, but it is... It's one of those days.
Well, so I was going to share with you my Kettleman experience, but it wasn't nearly that horrible. But I got here, honest to God, I was here maybe 5 minutes before you were, 5 or 10 minutes. So I must have been at Kettleman's in between your two visits. But when I got there, there really wasn't a big line, and which was actually even worse because I got my bagel, I got my cream cheese, I got my Vizo, I walk over, I'm like doing the thing, and then there's like nobody at the counter. And so they just finished with someone. So I put my stuff on the counter. Oh, no. They can't actually, like, ring me up, though, because they're trying to figure out how to use these, like, 300-year-old carbon things for the credit cards.
Well, they don't even have the thing.
No. And that's the thing is that they had tried to do something with someone's card, and it didn't work. And so she's like, well, I'll just write the – sir, I need your card. I'll just write the numbers down. And so don't – you know that hatred you feel when you put your stuff on the counter?
Yes.
And you're ready to go. And they call the person who should already be done by now back.
Yeah.
And then this guy, of course, he's going to be Mr. Helpful. So he's showing them how they can take one of the little plastic things with numbers that go on the tables – and use that to run across the credit after you carefully position the carbon thing over the credit. And then you can, and I'm just standing there going, and it's everything I can do, not just go. Because I'm doing the same thing you were. I was running just enough behind, but still it was that thing of like, well, it's only 20 of, I've got plenty of time.
Yeah.
You know, I'll just run and get this and then get to the studio. And so I'm standing there watching them do that. And then, okay, well, Maya. Well, what should we do with this? Well, Jim, maybe you should cancel out the thing. And I'm trying not to just yell, I have cash!
And
Let me just give you my money!
So he was demonstrating to them how they could use it as like a like an ice scraper sort of a thing to make the imprint of the card.
Right.
And meanwhile, you're waving like a $5 bill going like, I can pay you now!
Yeah. I don't even need my change! Let me just throw $10 at you and leave!
I swear to Christ, I was like this... And I, you know, the better angels of my nature sort of kicked in. But I was like this close to just saying like, look, here's the thing. This is like $1.99. Here's a 20. I'll come back later today, and you'll just have to trust me, and I'll trust you. But I have to leave. I mean, it was, you know. And then, of course, I just looked like I must have looked like I was detoxing from heroin or something, because as soon as she said, like, okay, that'll be $1.99, I'm like, okay, I'm going to pay. She's going to give it to me. Great. I can open it. And then I'm just shotgunning the thing at the cash register, like, oh, sweet life-giving Vizo. It's so sad. It's just... God damn. Whatever. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's like, doing this job, it's like, but, you know, our worst day is still much better than, you know, a lot of people's best days at this gig. Yeah. But, I mean...
And the woman at Kettleman's was very apologetic to me for the way... And I told her the truth. I said, you know, I understand. I used to work at Starbucks. And our system went down at Starbucks one morning. And we had to do this. And that was one of the worst days of my life. Is that I had to do... Because nobody brings... freaking cash to Starbucks. And it's like everybody wants their coffee, and it's like 6 o'clock in the morning, and there's like 20 people, and you're having to explain our computer system went down.
God damn.
I can take your credit card, but I have to write it out by hand. And then you're just going, I hate my life.
Somebody says, I left the dial ATM era in 1995. What is going on there? He says, this, by the way, is a store pet peeve with me, says this person via Skype. 1,000 bottles of vitamin water and Gatorade and nothing else. Which is, like, are there really that many? And then you see them stocking things that you know nobody's even bought. Nobody is buying, you know, like, what is that? What is that little, that a bottle of, like, tonic water? Like, the single serving of tonic water? No one's buying that. No one anywhere is coming in to buy the Canada Dry, like, the single serving tonic water at the AM PM.
No.
Somebody who's doing that is a serious drinker. Guess what? They don't need tonic water. Serious drinkers don't even need a glass.
See, I have some of those little individual bottles of tonic water at home, but I can't imagine any situation where I would need to buy one at AM PM. It's like,
God damn it,
I'm in my car and I have gin, but I don't have any tonic.
This person says, when I'm in a big traffic jam, when I get to the front, I want to see blood on the highway, not some idiot with a flat tire. No, I'm seriously, I'm with you. And there's something, these are my final things, we got to get underway. We got Eric Snyder who's going to join us. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, I got nowhere to be because there's probably just more pain and suffering waiting out there in the world for me. But there is something about Tuesdays. I don't know what the deal is with Tuesdays. There is something about Tuesdays in this city where the traffic... Maybe it's that on Monday, everybody sort of oversleeps, and they're just like, F this, it's another week, I'm going to stay at home and sleep in for 10 minutes. But on Tuesday, they've resigned themselves to their fate, where it's like, oh, life sucks. I might as well just go right into the teeth of the storm. Because on Tuesdays, it takes me, I would say, 30% longer to get anywhere in the morning.
My husband finds that he goes to his gaming night on Thursday nights. He leaves our house at like 6 and drives to Southeast Portland, and he always hits bad traffic. And the thing is, on Monday or Tuesday nights, I leave my house and drive down the same stretch of highway to go to like movie screenings. Traffic is always just fine at exactly that same time. But he said, for some reason, on Thursdays, every single Thursday coming north on the 5 into Portland is just like hell.
There is some weird ebb and flow to the way that people operate during certain days of the week. I have no explanation for that. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Show. We'll do some news here in just a second. We've got Pop Culture Authority coming up. Today we'll answer this question. Is John Lennon really saying, I'm not going to hold your hand? Also, Mr. Eric Snyder will join us, and we'll do the top five songs inspired by a horror film. This is all brought to you by Castalia Language Center, where you can learn to speak. I was going to say, it might actually be the international language, the one that's not love, or maybe banging on your steering wheel, which is the universal sign for, are you kidding me? I have places to be. Castalia Language Center is based in downtown Portland, and they are at portlandspanish.com online. That's where you can find out more about them. Clara Grebel, who is a native Spanish speaker from Argentina, she now teaches Spanish language to folks who want to learn it as a second or a third language, and specifically to adults, because you just, speaking of frustrating, you've just been there with some kid. He's barely past being a fetus, and he's already multitasking on the language front. So, you don't want to be in a class with, just a bunch of little Mensas. It's just going to make you feel like you know what you're doing. So you go to portlandspanish.com. You find out about Castalia Language Center, where they teach Spanish language to adults and in class sizes of no more than 8 people. So it's you and how many other people?
Siete.
Well done, which means that you're going to learn, at the same rate, the same way that they do, near individual attention, and of course, they're going to find something that works with your schedule and with your language ability as well. So if you're a beginning Spanish speaker, they got something for you, but if you're just brushing up, they got you taken care of on that front, too. Castalia Language Center at portlandspanish.com, a proud sponsor of all of the Rick Emerson Show, even the bitter, hateful parts. Especially those parts. PortlandSpanish.com is the website there. PortlandSpanish.com. Ladies and gentlefolk at the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
The downturn in the economy has many people looking for ways to cut their spending, and many are taking a chunk out of their religious contributions. That's adding to the rising problem of churches facing foreclosure. Dan Mikes is a banker who specializes in lending to churches. He says the national financial crisis has been a problem, but so is the fact that many churches tried to grow too quickly.
It was a build it and they will come mentality that kind of set in the industry. And the reality is that a lot of these churches, perhaps in part due to the economic downturn, did not grow into their debt as they anticipated that they would.
You know, I just saw something yesterday. It was on the, I don't know if it was on Drudge or something. One of those, like the mega churches, it's just these huge, massive metropolis style buildings with the congregations of like 20,000 people. One of them actually just filed bankruptcy, which is, A, makes me happy just like on the face of it. But also, it's interesting because apparently that's the first time it's happened. It's like over the longest time when Taylor Clark wrote that Starbucks book a couple years ago. And at the time he wrote the book, this was true, and it's not true anymore. But he said that there had actually never been a Starbucks that had to close for lack of business at that time. And then it was news. We didn't really know it was the recession yet, but it was news then about 6 months later that like, oh my God, the very first Starbucks had to close because they weren't making any money. Now the first megachurch has had to close, which is, that really is, and it's like the thing, the Starbucks and churches and Vegas, like those are the three things that you figure that you're just going to make money regardless. So that really is, that is an indication that perhaps things are not quite solved yet.
I wonder how many churches would have to close if they were forced to pay taxes.
Here's the thing about that is that, I'm all for churches paying taxes. But I also realize that they would just find a different way to soak the congregation. That's the thing. Let's be honest. We make actual corporations pay taxes now, but it's not like they do. You know, or and it's not like and it's not like they pay taxes anything approaching the level at which they probably ought to, or that they find a way, you know, they somehow don't make profit. So churches, they would just have to find alternate revenue streams. But anyway, so it was weird because then they were asking this question about, like, what are we going to do with this building? Because it, you know, mega church building, it's not like you could just turn it into a warehouse. I mean, it's a pretty specific style of architecture, and they were unclear about what they were going to do with it. Here is Don Taylor.
Professor Jonathan Walton with the Harvard Divinity School says it's turning a financial problem into a spiritual one.
For congregations then to have to come to grips with the fact that their sincere investments in the faith and in God are now being seized by banks, that can become a point of spiritual crisis for many.
Well, God's not really, he's difficult to audit is the thing. So, you know, I don't really know that, and as somebody once said, it is interesting that God is all-powerful, all-seeing, all-knowing, but just can't handle money. Just,
well, you know, and if you believe that God is actually, like, on your side, if he's actually, you know, watching you and guiding you, and he's the celestial puppet master, but ultimately, you know, he is doing all of these things for your own good. Yeah, it's got to be kind of startling if your church, you know, goes under.
Well,
you know, because if you've decided that pretty much everything good and bad that happens is, you know, God's will, well, you know, if your church, if they foreclose on your church, then, you know.
I think it's like how eventually you decide that your kid's going to have to bail himself out of jail. You know what I mean? You know, maybe once when you're young as a youthful indiscretion, maybe later on if you've got something of your own that you can put up as collateral. But the third time your kid calls you at 3 a.m. because he's, you know, hit a guy with a broken bottle at a bar in Tuscaloosa and he wants you to come get him out, and you just go, ooh, no, not going to happen. But you let me know how that works out for you. You know, and then you just turn the ringer off and go back to sleep. I would say at this point, if you're making, like, you know, money hand over fist and also you don't have to pay taxes, God has answered enough of your prayers. You know?
But I'm just saying, as a member of the congregation, though, not as the person who actually owns the church, but as a member of the congregation, you've, you know, sort of bought in hook, line, and sinker to, you know, the fact that this is your church and you have chosen the proper spiritual leader and that God is, you know, God is orchestrating everything. And then, well, God has decided that your church, you know, shouldn't exist anymore. There's got to be this point where you just kind of go, do I still believe that everything God does is in my best interest? Now realize that he's just spiteful and petty?
God is some sort of heavenly Les Moonves who's just looking at a balance sheet and going, Portland, we can lose that, right? All right, anybody in Portland we care about? No? All right, yeah, we'll lose Portland. That'll put us in the black, I guess, for fiscal quarter three. Here is Don Taylor.
The nation's largest for-profit college, the University of Phoenix, is getting sued by Oregon for allegedly misleading students in the state on how it deals with student loans. Karen Johnson said she insisted on paying for classes herself when she signed up at the University of Phoenix. Weeks later, she learned the school had taken out a loan in her name and sent her a check. She claims she immediately sent the money back, but the school sent her name to the collections department, hurting her credit rating. It's keeping us down when we're trying to make a better life and do better things, she said.
So this is where they just defaulted to giving her a loan, whether she wanted one or not.
Yeah.
Ah.
Oregon's attorney general said Johnston has not been the only student with serious complaints. An enormous number of people in this recession are going to these schools to try and get a leg up. And unfortunately, a very large percentage of these programs are not doing much good, he said. They're actually sending people backwards instead of moving them forwards.
This is like that jazz where your bank will just send you those weird blank checks that you can make out for any amount. Remember the first time I got one of those where it was like, you know, hello, Richard. Please accept these checks. I said, you're awesome. You can fill these out for any amount of money, up to and including an amount that exceeds your balance. Have at it. And I just had and I had never gotten those before. This may be 3 or 4 years ago. And I finally asked them, like, honey, the bank just sent me these weird blank checks, and it just says I'm supposed to fill in the amount and then cash them. What is up with that? And she immediately came in. She didn't even tell me. She came in, and she actually took them out of my hands. And walked into my office, and I just heard the as they were being shredded. And then she came in. She's like, baby. She's like, I know you're intelligent, but I wanted to just get rid of those before we have to talk about it. She's like, if you get those in the future, because she's got like a way better credit rating than I've had for most of my life. And so the bank is like, you know, they've tried to bring, you know, to get money out of her for the longest time. But then they realized that wasn't going to work, and so then they just moved on to me. But yeah, that's the thing. She just destroyed them so they wouldn't even be in the house. That's sort of what this is, except it's like where they fill in your name and then they cash it for you, and then you, like a guy hits you for the 9% interest or whatever.
Jesus.
Well, apparently also the University of Phoenix has been misleading investors by cooking their books. And so Oregon is suing them for $10 million.
All right. Fantastic.
So, yay.
Let's do one more here, and then we will pause, take a breath, assess our next direction, and move forward.
Okay. In a bizarre shooting in front of an upscale restaurant in downtown Sacramento on Saturday night, police said a member of a jazz band pulled a pistol and shot one of two men who had picked fights with a waiter, a homeless man, and the band member. The band member, who police did not identify, was detained but not arrested.
Hey now, dig the hot lead.
The events began shortly before 7 p.m. when two men described as large white men in their 20s, possibly intoxicated, tried to pick a fight with a valet parking attendant and mooned patrons at Ella Restaurant in Sacramento. The men crossed the street to the Broiler Restaurant, where they entered the building and again started trouble. As they exited the building, the men touched one of several human-sized cat figurines belonging to a jazz band that was playing on the patio just outside the restaurant.
This is an odd story.
A band member told the men to stop touching the giant cat figurines. At that point, a homeless man in his early 20s confronted the two men, and they beat him.
I wonder if the guy actually said it just that way, though. Like, if he was on to, please stop touching the giant cat figurines. Because that would be an oddly specific instruction to give.
So he told him to stop it. Then a homeless guy said, hey, stop touching the cat figurines, I guess, or something. And so they beat up the homeless guy. They punched a waiter who tried to intervene, knocking him to the ground. Then the two men punched the band member and backed off. But when they came at the band member, he pulled out a pistol and shot one of them.
You don't want to screw with a jazz musician because he's almost certainly high. And it probably has nothing to live for but cheap kicks and fast thrills.
So the police are going to refer the case to the DA's office to determine if this counts as self-defense and if charges are going to be filed. Meanwhile, patrons at the two restaurants continued to eat and enjoy their drinks as they watched this going on in the patio outside.
So you're like getting a little bit of dinner theater along with your jazz. But how embarrassing is that, though, just either being shot by or having your ass beaten by a jazz musician? I mean, it's just...
After touching his cat figurines.
I mean, can you think of a less manly way to go out than having a jazz musician beat your ass? The guy who has probably ingested enough hallucinogens that he can barely stand. So, all right, well, whatever. Smith & Wesson, make it cool for me. And this is all true. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. We got a corpse watch on the way. Is this the corpse watch we didn't get to yesterday?
Yes.
Now, see, I say that, but here's the thing. I still don't know what it's about, so it's going to be fresh to all of us because I have no idea what it's regarding. Taser watch coming up later on. We'll talk to Mr. Eric D. Snyder. He will join us in the studio here in just a skosh. Also, the top five. Top five songs which are inspired by and draw their titles from horror films. Correct?
Correct.
Bam. Did that on the fly. I did. And so forth. Don't forget to be submitting your Geek or Lantern submissions to contest@rickemerson.com. That is contest@rickemerson.com. And you can go to rickemerson.com/pictures and look at the photo gallery for all of the submissions that we've got currently. You can do that as we speak, including the one which is the fully functional computer that's placed inside the which. And at first I thought, see, here's now. And maybe it is because I have to sit and watch it again, because when I listened to the guy give this sort of narration all the way through, I was busy doing some other things, and I've gone back and I've watched bits of it, but I have to listen to it, you know, the front to back again. At first I thought it was one of those things like when you make the clock run with like a potato or something.
Oh, you thought he was running the computer with like pumpkin power.
I mean, and don't get me wrong. It's great now. But at first, I thought he was trying to indicate that he had somehow harnessed like the power of the gourd or whatever. To run something, which I guess maybe.
No, I think he's just using the computer as the case for the computer's innards.
You know, which is still kind of great. But it reminds me of the. There's two things, and I don't know how they work. Really more than two, as probably even the most casual listener knows. But for our purposes here, two, on which I'm going to focus. One, that dipping bird thing. I don't know how that operates. I have no idea. None. Zero.
That's not what I don't know what I was expecting you to say, but that
you were thinking I was going to say like nuclear fission or something, or
yeah,
electrolysis.
I wasn't expecting you to say that dipping bird thing.
No, let me tell you about that goddamn dipping bird. I know it sounds like I'm disproportionately peeved at life today, but it's really not the case. Can I just tell you like five different times? And this is a thing. This is some sort of a familial trait, because growing up in my home, multiple times did my father go out and acquire somewhere a dipping bird and then bring it home and set it up on the table and try to get it to work, only to then, like, smash it into little pieces angrily that night after, like, a half rack of Heineken had been ingested because he couldn't get the dipping bird to, you know, move or dip or do anything at all. And I would just hear this sort of a crunch and the dip, one less bird as it would go into the trash. And I just hear my dad cracking open another Meisterbrow and going, "Goddamn bird!" And then it would just go into the... But it wouldn't stop him from buying another one, like, the next week. And the thing is, like, I wanted to intervene and go, "Dad, look, man, it's not working. It's never going to work. Just give it up." But instead, he would get another one. And he was, at that point, he was already like, I don't know, however old. He was like 40. And I wanted to be like, "What are you, you know, why don't you just get another, collect stamps or something?"
Well, your father, we have talked about it. Your father was also a police officer or a fireman or something.
He was a cop early on, yeah.
Because my dad had been a cop and then later became a fireman. And I know my dad was fascinated with how things work, which is why he would and plus firemen have way too much time on their hands because they're off duty a lot. So he was always like building things and trying to do. And I remember he went through this period where he was fascinated by lava lamps. Whenever we would go by a store or a gift shop or something that have lava lamps in the window, he would stop and he would just watch it for the longest time because he had to know how the damn lava lamp worked.
Did he ever take one apart?
No.
Buy it and take it apart?
I think he actually went into a store once and was talking to the guy at the store. Like he dragged me into like a head shop and then was like making the guy explain how the lava lamp worked.
At one point I actually knew that because I looked it up in some book, you know, in sort of the early internet days when you couldn't just find the stuff online. And it had something to do with like exactly the right kind of oil and the right density of wax and the whatever. And then, so I had a lava lamp. Actually, the lava lamp that we grew up with in our home when I moved away from home at 18, I forget why. I guess because I was kooky. My mom said, "You know, well, is there anything you need? Was you go out and strike out on your own path, son?" And I said, "I'd like to take the lava lamp with me." And she said, "I guess because I thought it would help me get chicks," which was a stupid idea.
It's the one thing that will make you cool.
Yeah, not money or, you know, like having a real job and an actual career. No, lava lamp. Which didn't work, especially because I dropped it on the floor of my new home. Like I moved into an apartment, and like a day later, like psh, smashed it on the ground. I found out then that it was, in fact, oil, because that stain never... And it fell and smashed after it had been running for like an hour. So then it's like hot oil and then like liquid wax. It just goes on the carpet. That's never coming out, by the way. That really is where you just have to set fire to the home. I mean... God bless Michael Beatty, about whom we'll talk more later. Maybe he could, but I mean, I'm telling you, that's like sword from the stone right there. So I don't know how the lava lamp works. It sounds like, but see, you're a better man than me. It sounds like your dad was bested by that too. But also the potato clock. I have no idea. Don't bother to explain it, because it's not going to stick with me. That's going to have no purchase at all in my head. No adhesion will be had by that fact. But the thing is, you know, I don't really need to know, because the guy who built the clock, he understands. And that really is, you know... That's sort of enough. It's like I don't really need to know like how Brownian motion actually works or why I care about it. There's some guy named Brown who figured it out, and you know what? Checked off the list. So Joe Squires is quite like that. Squires Electric is one of our fine business partners. You can find out more about them at squireselectric.com. 503. Don't call them about a dipping bird, though. Don't be like a wise ass. Go, "I got this I got a problem at my house. Can you come out here?" And then he gets into like your Dayglo Jim Morrison poster won't light up correctly or something.
And he'll just charge you like $150 because you're an asshole.
Yeah, and then punch you in the mouth. He probably won't punch you in the mouth. He'll punch you inside. He'll punch you here. 503-252. This isn't going the way I expected it to. 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. 252-1609 or SquiresElectric.com. The point is your home is filled with a lot of things that just work until one day they don't, or you need them to work differently. And at that point, you call a guy who knows what he's doing, and that is Joe Squires at Squires Electric. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical contractors, full-service electrical contractors, everything from residential, which... You know, everything from deciding you need more power outlets in one room because suddenly everything you own needs to be plugged into a wall. Or you're like me, where I've decided now that I have to have an iPhone charger in like every single room of my house, and like every place I might conceivably spend any time at all, there needs to be a wall charger there, because the idea of my iPhone having less than a full, it's become like a gas tank that I must obsessively top off like throughout the day. If you just decide you need more outlets, whatever, you're getting the whole condo made, or you're redoing your house, doesn't matter, he can take care of all of that. Squires Electric at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. On the way, we have Mr. Eric Snyder, who will join us. We've also got Pop Culture Authority coming up here in just moments. Corpse Watch, Taser Watch, the Top 5, and more. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program right here at the Emerson News Network.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Is John Lennon really singing, "I'm not going to hold your hand"?
From the Emerson News Network, this is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Rick Emerson. Let's establish a few things right up front. "I Want to Hold Your Hand" is a monster of a song. Released at the end of 1963, it sold 250,000 copies in its first 3 days. At one point, selling 10,000 copies an hour in New York City alone. In Britain, the song generated 1 million advance sales, the opening salvo in what one music historian has called bloody pandemonium. It conquered the British charts, finally receding some 4 months later, only to reappear within a matter of weeks, becoming a hit all over again. "I Wanna Hold Your Hand" was number one on the U.S. singles chart for 7 weeks, leading into a year in which the Beatles would utterly rule the world. The song has won the Grammy Hall of Fame Award, is one of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame's 500 songs that shaped rock and roll. The National Endowment for the Arts named "I Wanna Hold Your Hand" one of the top songs of the century. "I Wanna Hold Your Hand" is ranked as the 23rd best song of all time in an aggregation of critics' lists. And the track has reached a whole new audience via its inclusion in the Beatles' Rock Band. All of which makes it a little odd that virtually no one appears to have ever noticed the weird thing that John Lennon does about halfway through the song. Just as the band is gearing up for the third chorus, John and Paul, who share lead vocal duties on the song, take divergent paths, with Paul singing the straightforward "I Wanna Hold Your Hand" line, and John singing what, for all the world, sounds like "I'm Not Gonna Hold Your Hand." It's a one-time occurrence, at least as regards that particular track. The song, like most Beatles tracks, is full of odd sounds and whispers, as well as a mysterious, uncredited Hammond organ being played by who knows. But back to that line, "I'm not gonna hold your hand." Well, that can't be right. After all, "I Wanna Hold Your Hand" is a straightforward love song, poppy and peppy and full of sparkling teenage adoration. While intriguing half-lyrics make perfect sense when used in later works like Revolution, just placing an arbitrary rejection in the middle of the band's first saccharinesque smash would seem to have no real point. And anyway, there was no Beatlemania yet. Surely their producer, surely the band's record company, would have not allowed such overt strangeness. After all, this was still the era of button-down conformity. So, let's listen. First, the build-up to the song's initial chorus, where all sounds normal.
"And I say that something, I wanna hold your hand."
Now that same section sung a little later, when you will, perhaps for the first time, hear John Lennon clearly say, "I'm not gonna hold your hand."
"When I say that something, I'm not gonna hold your hand. I wanna hold your hand."
And it really is there, plain as day, yet curiously unremarked on. Perhaps adults, having been told that rock and roll was unintelligible, simply believed that and didn't bother to listen for lyrics. Perhaps teenagers, out of their minds on hormonal overload, didn't notice, or having noticed, didn't care. Maybe Capitol Records, startled by the unbelievable amounts of money they were suddenly making, decided not to look a gift horse in the mouth. And so the line remained. A cursory internet check for the phrase, The Beatles and I'm Not Gonna Hold Your Hand, reveals that apart from the jillions of copy-and-paste-centric lyrics sites, virtually no one has ever noticed or inquired about this musical oddity. One of the few who did was amateur Beatles historian Stuart Hirsch, who talked with Lennon at the White Plains County Courthouse, where Lennon was then being considered for deportation. Hirsch gave Lennon a 7-page interview, which Lennon kindly filled out and mailed back. One of the questions regarded the above lyric. Lennon matter-of-factly confirmed that at the moment in question, he is in fact singing, I'm not gonna hold your hand. Lennon then just as casually failed to give any explanation as to why.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. You can also email if you like, if that's your pleasure. It's Rick at RickEmerson.com, Rick at RickEmerson.com, or Dawn, D-A-W-N, at RickEmerson.com. Coming up later on, Corpse Watch, Taser Watch, also the day's top five. Top five songs inspired by and taking their titles from horror films. That's coming up later on in the hour. Top five songs inspired by, taking the titles from horror films, plus we'll be welcoming Mr. Eric D. Snyder to the program here in just a moment. You can read his musings and thoughts at, among other places, film.com and cinematical.com. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines so that ye might be amused and informed on this Tuesday.
Car crashes kill teens when they text and drive. Unicorns are not real. And there's kooky candidates in New York.
Okay.
Kooky.
I didn't know if you were going to do like a third K thing there.
No.
Kooky candidate capers?
There we go. That
All right.
Good.
Is a kooky candidate controversy leading to a conundrum?
Contrived kooky candidate controversies.
Contrived kooky candidate controversies leading to chaos.
cockamamie contrived.
Now, see, if you're cheating, you got to do the entire thing. You got to string it all together.
I was a cockamamie contrived candidate kinkiness leading to... Oh, fine.
Okay. Maybe we need to quantify these the ground rules of these ad hoc contests that we've never done before. It is the Rick Emerson Radio program. Our next guest is horrified that he has agreed to be on today's show. He writes for film.com, cinematical.com. He is a freelance writer, critic, columnist, humorist, bon vivant, raconteur, storyteller, overlord of all he surveys, and a stylish man of the world. Welcome to the Rick Emerson Radio program, Mr. Eric D. Snyder. Hello, sir.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How come you guys don't have a screen over your microphones and I do?
Because you're filled with germs and I would say filth of all varieties.
Okay. So my reputation precedes me.
Yeah, we don't like to actually just come out and say it. You know, we don't like to be rude about that. But
I understand.
I actually will say that. Well, the actual technical reason, because you are not the first person to ask that. One of these days, I get. Maybe it's not astonishing because I'm kind of a big radio nerd and whatever, and the technical stuff is sort of certainly fascinating to me. We get an astonishing number of people who email and they want to know the technical specifications.
Sure.
Of like what headphones I'm using or like what microphone, but people have asked about the windscreen. So you're singing with one of those things you see in the recording studio, you know, where it's like the guy's got the mic, you know, it's like James Hetfield and he's there like ready to bring the rock or whatever. And he's singing into this thing that is just a black circle that looks like it's sort of it's like a circle of pantyhose or something. Whereas Dawn and I do not. And it's because I have spent most of my life as an idiot DJ working with other idiot DJs who are just like half a rung above like rodeo clowns. You can't give DJs anything nice or breakable or fragile because it will be destroyed or filled with coffee and like bong resin
right
at the end of the week. So they have designed this microphone that I am speaking to you through now, which is the Electro Voice RA20. And in the Electro Voice RE20, the windscreen is actually inside. I swear to God, it's welded. It's like welded and bolted inside behind a metal screen where I can't touch it or get to it, because otherwise it would be broken or damaged.
I see.
That microphone is designed for more responsible people, like musicians.
But if you don't have the windscreen, you can hear the popping
and the
stuff.
So we all have a windscreen. It's just that mine is external and your guys' is internal.
That's what I'm saying.
Fascinating.
Sort of like my first metaphor was going to be crude. It's not like that at all. It's like an exoskeleton, endoskeleton kind of a thing.
Right, yeah. Okay.
And the thing is, I feel terrible. And I was going to say, we don't want to be too crude because Eric has a large following of people who don't like him to work blue. And so I already swore once, which we don't actually even swear on the show. Well, and I already like let off with.
Isn't this subscribers only though?
It is.
But it would be nice if some of your many followers.
Well, maybe they'll become subscribers. Yeah.
I would love to hear Eric Snyder on the Rick Emerson show.
And so this is we should tell everybody kind of what we're talking about. Then we'll get to news. We'll talk. We'll hang out. We'll ruminate. We got the top five coming up. Corpse Watch, Taser Watch, all that stuff. So we'll back up for just a second. For those folks who have listened to the show for any length of time, they've heard John refer to you. Is it to your Mormon book club?
My Mormon book club.
And this is just a book club that is so named because a preponderance of the members are of the Latter-day Saint faith.
Yes.
And so chief among them would be Mr. Eric Snyder.
I'm one of them, yes.
I have to say,
I don't know if I'm chief among them, but I'm one of them.
Here's the thing. I want you to take this the wrong way. I don't know if you're, as they say in the South, from these parts or if you're from elsewhere. I have to say this. You really do. You really look very, very Mormon. The facial
Oh, really?
Hair notwithstanding.
Right.
Having lived for many years in Salt Lake City, and my wife is from Orem, from Provo, and so
Don told me that.
I go back there every now and again, and it's like the facial hair is that's a bit of a tricky issue sometimes with members of the faith. But but it's like you full on. You've got like the complete
interesting.
It's like REI meets a guy who might be selling you something at a Kinko's kind of uniform that just seems to be everywhere inside the land of Zion.
That's actually the section that I shop at Macy's.
It's the Mormon section?
Yeah. Interesting. I had no idea. But yeah, the facial hair is to disguise myself.
So you can travel among the among the heathens.
Among the common folk, yeah.
Among the Gentiles, unnoticed.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Well, we'll talk about movies. We'll talk horror films. We'll talk about a whole pile of things here in just a moment. Let's do a little bit of catch-up and get the news with Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, This is Don Taylor.
Well, let's do that Kerps Watch.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It is Tuesday. Here is your Corpse Watch for Tuesday on the Emerson News Network.
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones. Exhuming things that's better left alone. But I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and alone.
Here is Don Taylor with your Corpse Watch for Tuesday.
An elderly woman police found dead on the bathroom floor of her Maryland home woke up several hours later as an employee from the State Anatomy Board went to collect her remains. The woman, 89-year-old Ruth Schillinglaw Johnson, lay on the floor for 3 hours while officers notified her family, doctor, and the medical examiner of her death. According to the police report, they noticed an odor similar to a decomposition smell in the house on October 1st after being called by a neighbor who had not seen the woman for a few days. When they found Ms. Johnson, she was reportedly blue and not breathing. The officers did not check for a pulse because they believed she had been dead for a number of days.
Okay, I'm confused about this. So they go to the house, there's the, I mean, they don't say stench of death, but clearly that's like the implication.
Yeah.
Also, she's blue and not breathing.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe this will be revealed later on what, in fact, was wrong with her. Has she just been put into some sort of, was this like a, is she wronged a voodoo practicing neighbor?
Is she always blue and not breathing?
That could be the case. She was 89, so I don't know.
So the death stink is just sort of, it just goes with the territory.
Right, yeah. Right.
So yeah, but I guess she may have just had a very stinky house.
Boy, you know, can I just tell you, this, about a year and a half ago, 2 years, I guess it was longer than that. It was when I was still on 970, so that would have been maybe 2.5, 3 years ago. I used to do this thing when I was at CBS where I would go, we would go door to door once a week. We would take people out of the listener database. You know, listeners would sign up for the listener club or whatever. And so we'd have their home address and their email and whatever. And this isn't nearly as creepy as I'm making it sound. But like once a week, I would, myself and like one of the people, one of the kids in the promo team would get in the station van and I'd get like a bunch of crap to give away. And I would just, we would go to people, to the houses where we knew people were listeners. And I would knock at the door. And they would answer, and I'd say, "Hey, I'm Rick Emerson from, you know, AM 970. I just want to thank you for listening." And I would come and I would hand them, you know, something, and then, you know, and then they would call neighbors to rejoice at their good fortune that I had visited their home and spoken to them personally. And then we'd get in the thing, and then we'd leave. And so we would do this to, I don't know, maybe 25, 30 houses a night because half the people were gone or whatever. But this girl, Terry, and I would go out and we would do this. And we went to this one house, and I forget where it was. I mean, it was like in a place where you don't think that people are going to smell like death. Like, it wasn't in Southeast. It wasn't on 82nd. Like, it was in a suburb where you figure that things are clean, you know? Things are clean and scrubbed, and there's, you know, there's like a deep and abiding shame, but it's shoved so deep inside that it never actually touches the outside air. And where all of the sins and decompositions are, you know, they're hidden away.
Like in the opening of Blue Velvet.
Exactly. And so we knock at the door, and it's like, and it's one of those houses where it's like, it's bad news, because you knock at the door, you press the doorbell, and immediately you hear the squalling of children and the barking of a dog and like the shouting of a minor bird and the meowing of a cat and like somebody bumping into something and a TV tray being knocked over and whatever. And so the front door opens, and it, you know, sometimes when the front door is sealed, it's a really tight fit. When it opens, there's that sort of vacuum, like a whoom.
Backdraft.
Yeah, exactly. So they open the door. And so the air sucked in, and then it comes back out. And so we didn't notice it right away. But I swear to God, it was like we had just stumbled onto some sort of a rendering plant that was being stashed inside the suburbs. It was unreal. And it was like a 12 or 13-year-old girl. And we didn't say anything for a second. And then finally I said, hi, is Enid Schlarperstein here? And she said, yeah, that's my grandmother. Hold on a second. And she went into the house to get her grandmother, who was, I guess, the listener. And Terry and I just sat and looked at each other. And it's like the smell coming out of the house. It was like nothing. It was one of the worst things I've ever smelled in my life. And the woman came, and it turns out it was all misunderstanding. It was like her daughter has the same name and whatever. And so we didn't really need to be there. But I have never been so glad to get away from this. It was like I could smell it in my sleep that night. It's like I wanted to score out the inside of my nostrils. And I really, to this day, I really honestly wonder if it was one of those houses that eventually turns up in a news story where Carl Click says, you know,
Neighbors of a tiger at home and always wondered about the strange aroma. Now they know why, and then they just see like a bunch of Cub Scouts being wheeled out of the basement 5 years after they vanished.
Or Grandpa was just, you know, propped up on the couch.
I swear to God, it was
for
so,
5 years.
Maybe it was a rendering plant.
I mean, they got.
Why not? Times are tough. Start a rendering plant at home.
Yeah, they were making soap.
Yeah,
you know, in the suburbs.
It's Amway's exciting new home-based business.
Sure.
What if I told you that you could never leave your home and increase your income? Do you know what a dead cow looks like? All right, here's Don Taylor.
Well, at any rate, the woman, she was 89 years old. Blue and not breathing. Remember her?
Oh, yeah.
The officers didn't check for a pulse because they thought she'd been dead for a number of days. Her son told the police that she had made arrangements with the State Anatomy Board to donate her body for science. So when the person came to pick up her body to take it away for science, that's when she woke up.
So this is sort of a, this is like one step away from the Monty Python, like the live organ transplant kind of a thing. Sort of an I'm not dead yet. Yeah.
Right.
So they took her to the hospital for treatment and she was discharged on Wednesday.
But this is an unsatisfying story on every level. I want to know why the blue.
Why was she blue? And isn't it against the law like to pretend to be dead?
Well, and I don't think she was pretending.
Well,
she was unconscious.
That's her story.
I mean,
it could have just been her idea of a practical joke.
Exactly. She lies there, makes herself blue. That's a thing she can do. Look blue, not breathe. Brings out the paramedics.
It's just for attention.
Yeah, because their kids never call her.
It's like a variation. It's like Howard Hessman's ability to turn himself purple. All right. That's your corpse watch for Tuesday in the Rick Emerson Radio program.
That corpse? This song, yeah.
It's a pseudo corpse watch.
Don, wasn't this the song they played at your wedding?
It's the Rick Emerson Radio program. We're here with Mr. Eric Snyder. Let's do one more here, and then we'll move on to other things. Here is Don Taylor.
All right. Put that down. Give me that.
All right. Children, don't make me come over there.
Footage of a unicorn running through a wood has been exposed as an elaborate hoax.
What?
To promote an upcoming science exhibition. Ontario Science Centre in Toronto, Canada, claimed it had sent the video by a group of intrepid myth hunters, and they were analyzing the footage. The video was posted on YouTube with millions debating its authenticity.
I dispute. Okay, first of all, no. I dispute that millions were, quote, debating its authenticity.
Yeah.
As one guy with multiple logins who is starting like some sort of a puppet flame war with himself, attempting to wangle an appearance, on bizarre destinations.
Well, in a statement, the Ontario Science Centre said they were reviewing the footage frame by frame to determine whether the claim was legitimate. With closer examination, we hope to establish whether or not a genuine unicorn sighting has occurred. The statement even warned the public to use caution if they think they see a unicorn and to not make any sudden movements or attempt to use flash photography. Although legends of unicorns state they are peaceful creatures, the statement said, scientists worry they may harm themselves or others if they end up on a road or highway.
No, they don't. No. Scientists don't wonder about unicorns crossing roads and whether it will be safe for them. That's just you're trafficking in fiction. That's just a tissue of falsehoods.
To be fair, the legends say that unicorns are peaceful, but legends also say that unicorns are fictional. If they're not fictional, then maybe they're also angry.
That's true.
And dangerous.
So maybe we've misapprehended their intentions in every conceivable way.
An emergency unicorn hotline was also set up.
Stop. It wasn't.
For further information on unicorns.
Stop. Here's the thing. You're being horked by this story. Someone is...
At some point, they revealed it's all a hoax, right?
Right.
Someone is...
Who was in on the hoax? Were the science people in on it, too?
The Science Center actually did it as a promotion for an upcoming exhibition.
All right.
They decided to reveal the truth about the video after causing some, media uproar. And he said, a spokesman said, we've received calls from all kinds of people, predominantly women, and some confused news reporters in response to the video. The reactions have been amazing. Women wish that it was true.
Okay.
Why would women wish that unicorns were true?
I don't know, but I'm so sad for everyone this month, like humanity just in general.
They did say, though, that some keen-eyed viewers reported knowing the video was fake by the way the unicorn's tail moves And the fact that it was not pure white.
And also that it's a unicorn.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's a tip-off right there.
Remember that thing that was obviously fake? Turns out it was fake.
Jesus.
That thing, of that picture of a fake thing, yeah, it was fake.
Do you ever watch, like, you'd be watching like, the History Channel or Discovery Channel or whatever, and they'll interview these guys who are like, you know, so-and-so is a cryptozoologist. But it's always a guy who has, like, a degree in something. Mm-hmm. It'll be a guy who is like, he'll have, like, a degree in some sort of, like, astrophysical science.
I study things that don't exist.
Yeah. And, you know, and then he also looks for the Sasquatch.
Yeah, at some point he just took some kind of a sharp right turn into crazy town.
Right. Yeah. Jesus. Huh. All right. Good God Almighty. So we're here with Mr. Eric Snyder, who, you're a guy who's sort of been on the periphery. Like, you've been one degree removed enough for me for the longest time that I've heard about you, but this is the first time we've met.
Yeah, we've never met until now, but yeah, Don is always talking about you. Always. Rick this, Rick that.
Never shutting up.
And every time I'm like, Rick who?
Profane mutterings.
Yeah. We meet.
Did you guys write together or did you guys work together at Cinematical? How was it that you came to know each other?
Let's see. Well,
we first met because we were both members of the Online Film Critics Society.
That's right.
And so we met through through lively discussions on the message boards.
And then I was going to be moving to Portland, and so I was looking for OFCS members that lived here, and Don was one. Mm-hmm. And so I emailed her and said, hey, I'm moving to Portland. Be my friend.
And I went, maybe. Sure, whatever.
Right.
Strange dude who I probably won't like in real life.
Right. And then we met at a screening and fell instantly in love.
You know, it's strange because I was at Don's birthday party a couple of weeks ago, and I'm trying to remember if I saw Eric Snyder there.
I was out of town.
I don't think I did.
I was out of town. Did you perhaps see the lovely gift I sent?
No, you know, but I also didn't see Mike Russell, so I suppose it's all been
He gave me the ukulele kit that I'm currently building.
Okay,
so.
Let's talk about this for a second. So I meant to get to this at the top of the show, but we just fell into this huge, like this protracted Cambodia of a discussion about the failing credit card system at the bagel place down the street. So let's talk about this ukulele thing, because you mentioned this the other day, and I think I got an email from somebody who thought that it was like that you were speaking in code when you said you're like going to be at home tonight building the ukulele.
I'm buffing my uke.
That's what the kids were calling it these days. So this is a so when you say this is like an actual real like a Tiny Tim style ukulele you were building.
I was on the phone with Eric Snyder one day. He had called me while I was actually because I've wanted to learn to play the ukulele for a while, and I was on the phone.
You're mistelling the story.
I am.
I learned of your desire for the ukulele. At Mormon Book Club one night.
Oh, I thought it was while we were on the phone.
No, we were at Mormon Book Club. We were in the Taylor's backyard, and we had to look up on Amazon the name of the next book or whatever.
It was.
And so Dawn got into her Amazon wish list and was showing. And someone else at the book club, not to name names, but it was Debbie Taylor, went off on this. She tells very long stories, and so Dawn and I would get bored with the story, and Dawn was sitting there with her laptop, looking at her Amazon wish list, and she says, "Oh, here's the ukulele building kit that I want." And so I remembered.
You did.
I remembered. And so when it came time for her birthday, knowing that I would be out of town, I ordered this ukulele building kit and had it shipped in my absence.
Is this from where does the desire to learn the ukulele come? Whence does that derive?
Do you even have a desire to learn how to play it or just to build one?
No, I want to learn
just
how to
have
it
around.
I've always wanted to play an instrument. And I tried learning to play the guitar once, and it was really frustrating because I have like kind of sharp fingers.
You have Lisa Simpson fingers.
I do. Yeah. And so it was very difficult. I played the flute for a while when I was in the fifth grade, but that was mostly so I didn't have to like go to math. So really, I've always wanted to. And I looked at ukuleles, and it's like, you know, they're small. And so if you have short fingers, I think, and they only have four strings.
True.
So I thought that they're relatively inexpensive as instruments go. So I thought I could learn to play the ukulele.
And you thought about that thing that's just like a washtub and a broom, and then you get like a string or something that just goes from the top. That's maybe one string, no waiting.
Actually, my first thought was, for a while, I was really interested in learning to play the banjo. But then it's hard and they're really expensive.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
So then I saw this ukulele building kit where I had this thing like, not only will I learn to play
it's
the ukulele.
It's hard on multiple levels.
But first I will build the, which, well, see, the thing
here
is.
Here are two things I'll never do.
It's something I can injure myself constructing and then I'll never be able to play it as well.
Well, I also thought.
Well done.
It's a kit, so I thought, of course, it's just ready to put together.
It'll be explanatory.
No, it's ready to put together. No, see, ready means that when you get it, it's like it's done. It's ready. That's what ready means.
See, a kit to me means that, like, here is everything you need.
That's what I would think.
To make this thing.
Is that not the case?
Well, it turns out no. And as my husband pointed out to me, there are many, many kits available for things that are wood crafting that are designed for people who either already know how to do woodworking and just want a simple project, or like young kids or teenagers or people who are first learning woodworking.
So you thought this was going to be like a Ravel model of the stringed instrument world, where you like tab A into slot B.
I thought it was going to be like IKEA, where there would be instructions.
I kind of thought something like that too. And then I thought that it would be easy to put together, and then it would just be me like finishing it with varnish and stuff. No. So far, I've had to spend like $30 on supplies, because like I had to get wood glue, and I had to like glue and clamp the neck on, and then leave that overnight, and then I had to like attach the fretboard. But before I attached the fretboard, I had this thing. It's like, take the positioning dots for the fretboard, and then you get at this, and you hammer them down into the pre-drilled holes.
Wow.
Except that the pre-drilled holes are too small
for
the damn positioning dots, and so then I cracked my fretboard a little bit. And,
the amount of time and energy it's going to take you to build, and badly build, I might add, this ukulele, really, in that amount of time, you could probably, collect a sufficient number of bottles and cans within the one square block surrounding your home and redeem them for a ukulele that someone has already made.
But think of how much you will appreciate this ukulele.
I'm just picturing you like holding it up there. You're like, and now my finished ukulele. And it's like an Art Fern kind of a thing where it's just all glued together.
It's like Homer Simpson's spice rack.
Ralph Wickham's diorama. Yeah.
just a conglomeration of crap that's been solidified with like a big tube of epoxy that came open.
You'll strum it and it'll explode.
Well, as it is now, I'm enjoying the process right now, even though so far all I've done is put the neck on like glue and clamp the
fretboard.
I'm
glad you can rationalize this to yourself. No, the journey is what it's all about, Rick. It's not about function.
Is. There is sort of a zen enjoyment that I am getting from the process. Because also, I'm really all about like instant gratification.
I don't think you understand what zen really means.
Well, no, this is the thing.
I want to be zen now. This is good practice for...
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because the thing is with this, I have to be patient. It's like... I had to like get the neck on there just right and glue it, and I had to clamp it. Then I had to leave it overnight. Then the next evening, it's like I have to glue and position and clamp the fretboard.
Let me ask you
this. Then I have to leave that overnight. Now I'm going to have to actually start like staining and finishing it.
So this whole process will make you a better person, is what you're saying.
It's teaching me to be like patient.
Let's place money on that right now.
And in the moment.
I can already tell that it's making you more centered. Let me just ask you this. I get so many questions about this. One. No. Five. How will you know? How do I put this? At what point in the process, and is it just at the absolute end, will you know if the ukulele is going to be functional in any way approaching the theoretical functionality?
I think what'll happen is that when I actually have completely finished it and get it strung, and then am like tuning it. If for some reason I cannot properly tune the ukulele, then I will know I have failed.
How will you? And I'm not saying isn't an answer to this. How will you know that the ukulele is properly tuned?
Because I'm going to have to spend more freaking money to get like a chromatic thing.
You have to carve that too. Hold on. No. I'm carving a diode. I'm gonna be up late. Just a second.
I need one of those little chromatic thingies to tell me if I've tuned my instrument correctly.
I might have one of those.
Really?
Or know someone who does that you can borrow.
Okay. Here's the thing. If the ukulele is even within whistling distance of correct tuning, you are obligated to come here and to perform something.
And the thing is, once it's done, and even if I fail with this miserably,
please
and
tell
have
me you're
going
to take lessons.
I'm going to learn from books. I'm going to teach myself, but I'm going to learn to play the ukulele.
Okay.
I actually have a bunch of books on my Amazon wish list already, including books to teach you to play classical songs on ukulele.
I am so sad for you in so many ways.
These books, of course, come unbound. You have to go buy the glue.
They send you a tree.
Right.
Here's some
tree and some ink. Yeah.
Here's a rubber tree plant. Have fun. FYI, you were... not the last time. Two shows ago, you went to Colton with me, right? It was like you and me and Patrick and Laura went to see John the Colton. Was that when the insanely freakishly talented chick from Beaverton or wherever played the ukulele thing?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just saying, as long as we're just setting our expectations at a reasonable level. I'm not saying you can't achieve, but I just, because it's that thing of like, well, it's only got four strings. Like, how difficult? And it's like a banjo's like only got, like at one point in a banjo, there's only like half a string. I remember trying to play the banjo, and after like an hour of that, I was like, F this. I will never learn this. This is a thing I will never be able to do.
No, this is, it's going to be, I think actually building the ukulele is kind of getting me in this place where it's preparing me for the fact that actually learning it is going to be a long process as well.
I swear to God, you could write like a best-selling Oprah book of this right now, where it's like white woman from the suburbs learns something by building a ukulele, but then it's like the thing you learned can then just be distilled down for other white women, and you put the O on the front, and then it sells.
Eat, pray, strum.
Yeah. I mean, really, that's, you know, it would be like Zen in the art of, you know, building like a string instrument.
Maybe I should start a ukulele building and learning blog now.
There you go.
And then after, like, you know, after I get many people reading my ukulele blog, then I'll be able to sell it to a publisher.
There you go.
And turn it into a best-selling.
Tell people of your experiences.
Blog.
That's and I think you could just skip to the final step, where you write the book and then just, you know, you write the book and the blog concurrently, and then you can just create some backstory.
Well, and then I can tour Tony Robbins style, and
totally.
I can tell people how if they build their own ukuleles, it will empower them.
And then sing an inspirational song at the end with like a, you know, with like a disgraced NFL linebacker who had a Percodan problem. And he can, you know, and then you'll sing something about overcoming difficulties, and then everybody learns.
And I can use this as an excuse to like get an all expense paid trip to Hawaii, so I can go learn ukulele at the feet of a master for my own spiritual development, and of course for the book.
Right.
Just like the Pray Love Chick did.
By the way, I should say right now that you should at all times and for the duration of your life conceal all of this from Cheryl Kanakoa, who is our chief of staff, who is in fact from Hawaii and has arched a sort of has arched an unamused eyebrow at certain of my jibes about her
people?
I was going to say country, but her people and her culture over there. Well, because at Outlook Portland, I realized at one point, it's like every damn person I knew was from Hawaii. It was Cheryl was from Hawaii. Lisa Desjardins, born in Hawaii. Colin Ivey, who for the longest time was the cameraman producer at Outlook Portland, from Hawaii. Tim Oakley from Hawaii. It was like everywhere I went. It was like there was some sort of Hawaiian like mob.
We gotta seal the borders.
Yeah, there was
too many of them.
They were like white blood cells descending
jobs
on me.
Mm-hmm.
Just one final thing here before we move on, because we have some other news we should get to. We got Taser Watch. We'll talk to Eric Snyder about the, you know, actual film related things. We got the top five to get to. But you said something just a couple minutes ago. You were talking about the ukulele thing, and this is I have noticed now a pattern. This is very emblematic of you, Don Taylor, as a person. No, I'm not passing judgment. I'm just look at Christ. I'm not serious. I'm not like I'm, you know, I'm as nutty as you are, just, you know, probably more so just in different ways. So it's not like I'm anybody to, you know, throw stones. We're not even throwing stones, like, out of the house. We're just in the glass house throwing the stones at each other, basically. But you said that ukulele, which, and I have to stress this point, doesn't actually exist. It is like a theoretical ukulele at this point.
Right.
But you have, in fact, on Amazon already filled your wish list with, it's like replete with things you could, like instructional, you know, advanced ukulele, you know, renditions of John Denver songs. This is like hand in hand with the fact that you revealed to me, and I don't think I mentioned this on the air, that you were up until like 2 a.m. recently, like scrolling through the iPhone app store, figuring out what you would buy. And like your phone is from 7-Eleven. You don't have an iPhone. Your phone is just like a Barbie phone. It's like one of those phones that comes with candy at the plaid pantry.
Her cell phone is a rotary phone.
I mean, you've seen it. It's like
sure.
You know, it's like a thing that comes with mini gobstoppers that you get at the cash register. So, I mean, not that I don't admire your forward-thinking nature and all, but it's just you've got an odd way of approaching the
put in the cart before the horse.
We all have our own little ways of fantasizing about things, about thinking towards the future and thinking, well, you know, I mean, some people shop for vacations online even though they can't afford their vacation yet. I shop for iPhone apps for the iPhone I don't own yet.
All right. I will say, by the way, that I, for the first, and I won't go down to the whole thing about this, but for the first time, it was maybe 2 or 3 days ago, first of all, I lie when this is actually one thought in two parts. One, A, I did catch myself the other day, and I swore I wasn't going to do this, becoming that guy. And when it's that guy who talks about his effing iPhone apps all the time at everyone at a great velocity and a great deal of volume, whether or not they appear even like vaguely interested. Where I said, no, and then it does this other great thing. Look at feature number 5. And not knowing like the sort of glazed over look that they were, and, you know, and then I kind of caught myself. So you will have to be sort of a recursive check system on each other to make sure that we don't just do that all
Eric
the time.
Eric also is an iPhone person, but he...
Now, do you do that? Do you just say like, hey, and look at this thing I got that does this deal?
No, because I have the apps that I need for things. I don't have a lot of like fun extra apps. I've so far been pretty like just functional.
See, and that's my thing too. Yeah. It was a point of pride with me that all the apps I had, that they had a demonstrable purpose. They did something specific.
Right.
What are some of the, and we're not going to make a whole conversation of this, but like give me an example of an app you have that's productive, that's useful.
Let's see. Well, I have the PayPal app so I can check my account easily, see how much money I got in there. And I have, the one to do Twitter.
I got the there's like a Merriam-Webster dictionary app thing.
Stuff
so like
that.
I've got I've got that
Shazam. So if I hear a song and I need to know what song it is, yeah.
And I got the deal that turns your phone into a flashlight and whatever. And so sure. I got all that stuff. And but I was really like proud of myself that I had not just been that person who scrolls and goes, I'll take that which I don't need and this which I'll never use. And then for reasons that I even now can't really explain, it was like some sort of weird, like momentary, like Jedi mind control thing. Well, I found myself, I bought this app the other day for, it's just absurd. It was basically just like a thing that they create to target idiot Maxim readers. And it was just, it was the most ludicrous app. It was just a thing that like you point, like you take a picture of yourself, like you scan your face or whatever, and then it purports to, in fact, tell you how attractive you are.
Oh, wow.
Why would I ever buy that?
No, why would you?
I don't know.
I would think you already know how attractive you are.
Well, the answer is unbelievably attractive, Eric. I don't need that to be
exactly.
Independently confirmed.
Need an app to tell you that.
And it was like my hand, it was like sort of just Seth Green style. My hand was possessed and had a life of its own and downloaded the thing onto the phone before I even knew it was there. So
I do have the HAL 9000 app.
What is it? Does it just...
It just randomly...
Does it speak things in HAL's voice? That's fantastic. Please now to demonstrate.
Forgive me for being so inquisitive.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, every time you push it, it randomly says a HAL line.
What's like that David Lee Roth app that actually just does... It gives like random shouts and squeals.
Like David Lee Roth.
All right. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. We'll do some more news here in a second. We got the top five coming up. That is all on the way, my chums, mi amigos... Mi compadres. The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by a series of business partners, including CJ's High Climbing Services. And CJ'sHighClimbing.com, so you can find out more about them. That is CJ'sHighClimbing.com, just like it sounds, CJ'sHighClimbing.com. Or you can contact them via the phone at 503-228-9278. 503-228-9278. And Don actually said, you said something last hour. That I mentioned that Gary at CJ's High Climbing had that he'd sent me this. I don't want to post it because I think it was like for internal use only. I don't think I was really supposed to like show it to everybody. But he sent like
but you'll read it on the air.
I read part of it. I don't think I should. I shouldn't probably make a habit of that.
No.
But he sent like 3 pages basically of like here's what we do, here's the services we provide, and here's what maybe here's why people might want to consider using CJ's High Climbing as opposed to just like. You know, getting a ladder that you bought for $3.99 at a flea market and propping it up against your house in November so you can go up and scrape something off your roof,
or that you bought on Craigslist from a guy who goes around and steals people's ladders, like that story we read that one time.
Exactly. But you said something. This is today in Legion of News, and he actually, I'm gonna read this right here. He has the who calls us question. He was sort of letting me know, again, what kind of people typically use the service. He says. We get more calls from women than from men, and not for the reasons you might expect. He said, often, women don't want their husbands going up there anymore because the husband doesn't really know what he's doing, and they fear the worst. And you made some observation about that with Patrick, where guys have this sort of Edmund Hillary thing like in their head where if like there's an object of any size, they need to clamber up on top of it at some point. And always to remove something that seems like really strongly affixed to the top of the house. And always when the weather is the least suited for it. So that sounds like a thing it was like Patrick was doing that as well.
Oh, yeah. He's made those. When we were homeowners, he would make these reminders. I can just climb up in the tree with a chainsaw and just cut that branch off. And I'm like, no, you really can't.
No, Dagwood.
No. No, I've done that before. I don't care if you've done it before because you will fall out of the tree and you will die. Or worse, you'll, like, cripple yourself for the rest of your life, and I will have to bathe you. And I don't want that to happen.
That would be worse than him dying.
Yes.
As far as he's concerned, I'm sure.
Well, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, dying, I would just be sad if he's, like, you know, just a paraplegic. Never mind.
This took a dark turn all of a sudden.
Doesn't it always?
It really does. Well, all right then.
Don't fall off the roof.
If that's a fear that you, if you're afraid that you're going to end up having to spoon food into the mouth of Dawn's husband, Patrick, or perhaps chew his food for him, you can avoid that risk by contacting CJ's iClimbing. That is Gary, Sean, Bo, Lauren, or any of the people there on the crew. And they're actually, and this is a thing where it's not, you know, it's not like you're hiring them to come do it, and then they are in turn just like looking on Craigslist for like, you know, some guy who needs to earn like $4 or something. You know, they are employed by CJ's. They're covered by workers' comp. The company itself is covered by liability insurance. So you're dealing with an established, experienced company, and you're going to be able to, you know, to minimize a lot of those headaches, a lot of the worry. And it's like, and the other variation on the, like your husband or your boyfriend or whatever, thinking that he can just climb up there with like, you know, with like a screwdriver and some duct tape or whatever, and just fix anything that needs to be fixed, is like, sometimes it's your dad or sometimes it's your grandfather who's unaware that he is essentially just filled with dust where his bones used to be. And that he will do this, and it will go to then a cut scene of you like peeling peaches or something in the kitchen sink, and then just, you know, your dad plummeting by the window and somebody going, "Hey, that looked like dad. I don't know. He went by pretty quickly." So you don't want to worry about that.
I heard one of the people at CJ's High Climbing was bit by a radioactive spider.
It's entirely...
So there's no danger of...
That's not a thing
incident.
We can say legally, of course.
Okay,
we
sure.
can't actively say...
Right.
But it is a rumor.
...that they are endowed with it.
Some people say.
Some people say that. It's true.
Right.
You can find out more about CJ's High Climbing Services at 503-228-9278 or visit their website at cjshighclimbing.com. That is CJ's High Climbing. .com, a brand new business partner here on the Emerson News Network, dealing with maintenance jobs that are dangerous, messy, or unpleasant at your home. A proud sponsor of the Rick Emerson radio program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Car crashes kill an estimated 5,000 teens each year, making them the number one killer of teens in the U.S.
Still not enough.
Singer and actor Jesse McCartney says despite all the evidence, many teens still don't realize texting while driving can be just as dangerous as driving drunk.
This is my generation, and we're the future, and we need everybody around. You know, you're way more important than a text message.
Here's the thing about Jesse McCartney.
I don't know who this is.
But see, and I'm only one step removed from you in that I did know who he was at one point because he sang this song that my wife was really into, and it was, I can picture him. And the thing is, explaining who he is, like describing him, does no good because I was going to say that he looks like Ashley Angel from O-Town. That's no help to anybody in this room. Also, it's a pop culture reference from like 1905. So, but he's, you know, he's like one of those guys that they ordered out of an unthreatening boys catalog over the record company.
Is he the same person as the one who's the brother of the Backstreet Boy?
No, that's Aaron Carter. You're thinking of Aaron and Nick Carter, right?
Right, yeah. Okay, Aaron Carter. Aaron Carter, Justin McCartney, not the same person?
I don't believe so.
Dawn's got pictures. They look the same.
He does look like he came from the same farm where they grew Aaron Carter.
They're sort of generically blonde.
But that's and he's got the it's not really
he's got the shaggy Justin Bieber hair.
But it's shaggy in like the least dirty, least threatening way possible. But he sang this song that my wife is really into that seemed to be on in our home constantly for like 30 days or so, and then it went away, and I never heard of the guy again. But I'd sort of forgotten. He's kind of like Mandy Moore, where you just sort of forget that he exists until she cries. And then you go, oh, yeah, she's a person. I forgot about her.
Huh. Right. Anyway, he's very upset about teens texting. Is that the deal?
Yes, he's urging teen drivers to remove the temptation of texting.
A BlackBerry, it can drive you nuts. Put your phone on silent so that it doesn't distract you. Put the phone out of your sight, away. So that you can have your full attention on the road.
Did someone ask him, is he working off like a DUI conviction or something with this? Is that the deal? Did he grope somebody and we're only now hearing like the civil service part of it?
Why is this his thing?
I think he just deeply, deeply cares.
Well.
And also, nobody had talked about him in a while, right. So he needed to do something.
Let me just ask you this. We'll just go around the room here because I'm curious about something. He was just talking about the texting and the driving and the kids and the hey-hey and the whatever. So just now I want you to be totally honest and upfront about this. Don't traffic in deception here just for the sake of vanity. Don Taylor, so you have the handheld cell phone, like, you know, the BlackBerry or whatever. So do you talk and or text while driving?
Occasionally, yes.
Which or both?
I try to avoid texting whenever possible because it does take a lot of my attention off of the driving.
But in a generalized sense, it's a thing you are not entirely guiltless.
I'm not entirely guiltless.
All right. When is the last time, can you remember the last time you actually were texting something while you were driving?
It was probably sometime early on in us doing the show, and you had done one of those, hey, I'm running late things, and I texted you back.
Kay, thanks.
Kay, thanks. Me too. Like, really quick, as fast as I could with my right hand while I was, like, on the Twilliger curves or something.
Do you actually talk on the phone while driving?
I do, but it's I make it very, very quick and because I know it's illegal, and I do it in certain situations where I'm fairly sure that, like, a cop won't see me. Like, if I'm stuck in that stop and start thing getting on the freeway in rush hour and there are no police anywhere around me, then I might call my husband really quick and go, I'm on my way home. So, okay, gotta go. You know, and then I hang up really fast. So,
Eric Snyder, film critic for cinematicalandfilm.com. Do you, in fact, talk and or text while driving?
If I do talk now when I drive, it's with the hands-free device. Because I'm afraid of getting a ticket for that.
So is it like the Bluetooth thing, or is it like the
it's
cord
a thing
that you just stick
into
the
top?
Yeah,
it's that thing.
And I've got that too. And I say this, and I have to preemptively just like, please, just don't try to help me with this because I can't be. I am beyond. It is too late for me. But I can never figure out that the Bluetooth thing. It's like that is my old person thing. When the guy at the store was like trying to tell me, okay, I'm going to get you the Bluetooth, the Jawbone thing, and you'd be able to touch wireless. And I was like, do you have a thing with a cord?
Yeah.
Which is like wanting the Jitterbug phone with a dial or something on it, where I just wanted to stick the thing at the top.
I'm afraid the Bluetooth will interfere with the radio reception.
So will you? It's just one more thing for me to lose. That's my other thing. Do you text at all while driving?
No. I mean, I have, but it's definitely not a regular thing.
Is it because you believe that it's dangerous, or is it more because of the law?
It's not the law, because I have no regard for the law. but I figure if you're texting, you can kind of – you don't have to hold the phone up. You can hold it down, and, you know, people can't see that you're texting. But I'm afraid of wrecking. Yeah.
See, that's my thing, too, is in a weird way, because I will admit that we've talked about this, that I actually now have the headset, but it's turning into just like every fat-ass American. It's such a pain. I have to lift it up and I have to plug it in. So I will do the thing of holding the phone, the parallel, I guess, to my head, so that it has the thinnest possible profile, so the man...
Mm.
Yeah,
it can't see me. And plus, here's the other thing.
And
with
plus,
the iPhone.
Holding your hand up to your head like that, isn't it all suspicious to a,
no,
to
no,
a
no.
police officer?
No, no, no. I have this whole thing where it's like I look like I'm leaning on my hand like I'm real.
Right.
Like I've got a neck kink or something. And the great thing about the iPhone is it's got that proximity sensor. So when you hold it up to your face, the light goes off to save the battery. The light only goes on when it's away from your face. Yeah. So it actually it doesn't give the telltale glow at night. Mm. So it's like the long arm of Johnny Law will not be seeing that I'm on the phone. But the other thing, now that I've moved to the iPhone, you know what I can't do? I can't do the thing that I would do before, which is where when I saw the cop in my rearview mirror, I would just go, hold on a second, and I would just open my hand and drop the phone. And it would just fall into that crevasse between the door and the seat. I have occasionally caught myself texting over the last however many, you know, whatever, since I got the iPhone, and I do it for the same thing you just mentioned. It's because in like the weird Escher pain thing of my head, I figure... Well, that's a better thing to do because the cop can't see it because it's down below the dashboard,
exactly.
Which is probably not how I ought to be behaving.
No, because the thing about the texting is I've noticed it's like I do realize that talking on the phone is a distraction. But at least if I'm talking on the phone, my eyes are completely forward and I'm watching and I'm able to drive. You know, and again, I'm one of those people that, you know. But I'm safe when I'm talking on the phone. And that's not how it works. Your brain is operating differently.
And
the thing is with the texting is actually taking my eyes off the road. And that scares me.
And this was leading actually to – this is the question I was leading up to with all of the sort of pre-discussion. We were talking about the young Jesse McCartney and his quest to stop the texting. So now that we've all admitted, as I suspect like 98.999% of people with cell phones do, that we talk on our phones while driving – do you, though, still just instinctively and reflexively feel anger and contempt toward other people that you see talking on their cell phones?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
This morning on the way to Outlook Portland, I'm at the Aladdin, like at Milwaukee and Powell. and I'm at a and we're not even moving. And by the way, and I'm shaving while this is happening. I didn't bring it in with me. I left my other bag in the car. Usually I would have it here with me. But I have like the electric, you know, zzz, it's like the bathroom buddy thing. So I'm sitting there with my Norocco and I'm like full on shaving my face in the car, looking into the rearview mirror, like adjusting, not even moving my face, moving the rearview mirror down so that it no longer shows anything helpful behind me. And I'm like doing the thing of pulling my face and like making and shaving. And then I look over and I see a guy in the car next to me and we're both stopped. It's at a red light. And the guy's on the phone, and it's like I can feel my eyes narrowing, and I'm just thinking, you know, what is this creature that walks like a man yet just speaks on his cell phone while driving? Just filled with, like, all of this disproportionate rage. As then I'm, like, opening the sideburn trimmer, you know, and, like, going to work on the side of my head.
I don't get, like, really angry at people when they're just on their phones. Generally, I think, okay, well, whatever. Live and let live. Unless they, like, don't turn on their signal.
Unless they do something.
Unless they change lanes without signaling, unless they do something that is wrong. And then at that point, I go, oh, and you're on your phone.
You blame it on
and
the phone,
And then I'm just enraged.
Sure, right. Yeah. But of course, when you're on the phone, you're fine.
Right.
You know, it's like when you go to the drive-thru and when you're there at the window and it's taking forever, you're like, man, what's taking them so long inside there to get my food? But when the person ahead of you is taking forever at the window, you're like, man, what did they order? Like it's their fault, you know? But when you're the one up there, clearly, it's the employee's fault.
Let's do one more story here. We'll talk a little bit of movie stuff. Yeah. We'll get the top five and all of that. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. By the way, don't forget to join us tomorrow when our guest will include Ms. Kelly Clark, who will be in the studio.
Kelly Clarkson?
Yeah, speaking of... never mind. Yes.
Let's do our Taser Watch.
Here is your Taser Watch for... the hell is this? Tuesday? Tuesday, right here on the Rick Emerson Cavalcade of Whimsy. Fantastic. Here is your Taser Watch for Tuesday.
Authorities tased and arrested a teenager accused of fleeing deputies in Fort Myers, Florida on Monday.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida. Matthias Carvalho, 18, of Fort Myers, was charged with resisting an officer, driving without a license, and giving false identification to a deputy. Shortly before midnight, the Lee County Sheriff's Office received a report about two males in a car shooting paintballs at people and vehicles near Kenwood Lane in US 41. A deputy responding to the scene spotted the car near the Clarion Hotel on US 41. The deputy followed the car into the hotel parking lot, where he met with the driver, Carvalho, and an unidentified male passenger, and soon spotted two paintball guns in the back seat. When the deputy asked the males what they were doing, both made excuses.
Nothing.
The deputy returned to his patrol car to check the male's identification when Carvalho reportedly exited the car and ran away.
Excellent. Zoink! Well done.
Authorities chased him to a nearby grocery store parking lot where he was tased and arrested.
Fantastic.
During the investigation, the passenger admitted he and Carvalho shot the paintballs. The passenger said Carvalho fled because he'd given the deputy a fake name and did not have a license.
Wait, so how old are they? I mean, are they both
like 18?
Okay, so they're old enough that if they've done anything in the past that's lingering out there as a prior offense, that might be an actual real punishment coming for them.
They admitted they did shoot the paintballs.
Yes,
but they did not shoot the
deputy. He's kind of hunky looking, actually.
He's a handsome young man.
He doesn't look like the kind of guy that. Well, no. So here's the thing. There's something not quite right about his eyes. He's got the, upon closer inspection, you know what he looks like? He looks like one of those dirtbag kids that was hanging out with Claire in like the third season of 6 Feet Under when they were going to the weird art class or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
He looks like that. And he has sort of a waxen complexion as though he's like an evil doing mannequin
of
some kind.
Well, that could just be the lighting at the police station.
Yeah, and the weird color job that the printer did.
Yeah.
And he's
from Florida.
Yeah.
You want to talk about a product that sells to the 100% male customer base, and that's the paint gun.
Yeah.
And it's a thing, by the way, that is never used for its intended purpose. You know what I mean? Like, there's certain products that, I mean, they have some actual theoretical usage, but they're never really used for that.
I don't think people actually play paintball anymore. They play laser tag.
Yeah.
I'm not sure people actually play paintball. They just buy paintball guns to shoot at
just
cars.
Yeah, like bongs. I mean, water pipes. You know, that's what it's a water pipe, but no one uses it as a, you know.
Oh, for tobacco purposes.
Right, exactly. It's not a...
Something you'd like to share with the group,
Eric? Just say, well, I don't know if you've been to Portland.
Well done. We'll go out on that joke. I can't top it. There's your Taser Watch for Tuesday.
I can do it!
Fantastic. We're here with Mr. Eric D. Snyder, film critic at large, extraordinaire for film.com and cinematical.com. And I want to, before we do anything else, Don, and I'm glad I didn't forget this, Don mentioned something to me before the show that I wanted to ask you about. So she told me, if I'm remembering the story as you just sort of sketched it out to me correctly, that you... Was it that you got on? You had a song that got on the Dr. Demento show, where you recorded something that got on the Dr. Demento show when you were younger. What is?
Yes, that's right. You guys talked to Dr. Demento a few weeks ago. Didn't
we,
you?
If you go to the Rick Emerson archives, we had an interview with him about 5 weeks ago. So
if,
what is?
Give if me you story. Were to say to Dr. Demento, Eric D. Snyder, he would say, "Oh, sure, Eric, eccentric Eric." Perhaps he might say. What, that was the name that I used.
Please do explain.
That was you'd use the name Eccentric Eric?
That was my name, yeah. It started when I was like 13, when I first discovered the Dr. Demento show, and I recorded a thing. It was the first thing I did was one of those interviews where I was you interview someone and the answer is a clip from a song.
Right.
One of
those Mr. Jaws kind
right,
of
right,
thing.
Right, right, yeah, like those. And did one of those. This was 1987, and it was about the Iran-Contra thing. And so I was interviewing Ronald Reagan and then the Ayatollah, and I sent it in, and Dr. Demento played it. He had a show where he had his theme was recordings by young artists, and so there were like some famous young artists, and then also here was this thing by me, and he played it, and it was very exciting.
I mean, did you know? did he tell you in advance it was going to be played?
He had sent me a letter beforehand saying when it would be.
An actual letter?
This was 1987. There was no email, yeah.
Yeah, and so he just said, "Dear Eric, woo, I'm going to be playing your thing." And were you just, you're 13 years old.
I surely shat myself with joy, I'm sure. I told everyone I knew, told my teachers and my friends and family, and we all gathered around the wireless to listen. And it was very exciting. And then also...
do you have a copy of the show? Did you have a recording of it?
I do, on a record.
Really?
Because in those days, he did a live show on, it would have been KMET in Los Angeles in those days, but he also had his network show, and they were usually about the same. But so he sent me a copy of the record that went out to all the stations to play that show. I have a record.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
And this, if we can just nerd out for a second, I'm a huge Dr. Demento fan. I mean, like, you know, like 88% of people in radio. That's
exactly,
you know, one of the reasons I got into radio is because I used to listen to him. And it's and again, when I was around 13 or so, and I don't. And Dr. Demento isn't a thing. It's not a guy thing, but it is a nerd thing. And at that time, the nerd guy overlap was much stronger than it is now.
Right.
I think there were not. I just don't think there were as many female enthusiasts of nerd / geek things, or at least not openly as there are now. So it tended to, by default, was a guy thing. But the weird thing about the Demento show when I was, and you and I, it sounds like you were 13 and 87.
Yeah.
So we're almost exactly the same age. Right. And you were living where then?
Southern California.
Southern California. So. I remember, like, just, you know, listening to the Dr. Demento show when I was a teenager, and that's when you did those things, from 13 to, like, maybe 17. And then at some point, you know, it's like you got a sufficient number of hormones, and you went, oh, okay, I've moved on to other interests. You know, and other interests, that just involves a lot of, like, letting the water run in the bathroom, you know, like for hours on end sometimes. I don't remember anybody telling me where the Dr. Demento show was on, or in fact, that it existed. I just sort of discovered
somehow you knew
it. It was like it was like something went out in the sub ether, you know, in my brain. It was like when you wake up and your computer has auto downloaded like a new virus update or something, and it's like I woke up. I know Kung Fu, and that the Dr. Demento show is on now, and I went to listen to it.
See, I remember actually. I was like 10 or 11. I was at my cousin's house, and my uncle was listening to the show. My uncle apparently had not grown out of the nerdism. And my aunt, we were like, where's Uncle Johnny? And my aunt said, oh, he's out in the garage listening to the Dr. Demento show. I'm like, what's that? She goes, oh, it's a dirty old man. And so instantly I was intrigued.
Of course.
And so we went out and listened and fascinated. I think I remember he played the song Bounce Your Boobies by Rusty Warren that night.
I remember one of the first times I tuned in, he played this song by, it wasn't by, I forget the name of the artist, but it was this song called Polka Dot Undies.
Bowser and Blue.
Wow, that's embarrassing and awesome. Well done. I was going to say Kippadada, but he's the guy that did Wet Dream.
Yes.
Which is something that gets stuck in my, okay.
I may literally have Polka Dot Undies on my iPhone iPod right now, actually.
Here's the thing, Don, you are responsible for at some point reeling us back to reality.
But, well, since you actually had a Dr. Demento, you know, your nickname, so were there other instances? performances?
He played that one thing by me, and of course that to me opened the floodgates of like, wow, he'll play anything I send him. So I must have, I probably sent him literally 50, there were a bunch more of those interview kind of things, and then little songs, little parodies, little skits that were just recorded with my crappy tape recorder. At first it wasn't even multiple tracks, it was just one track, one take, me recording some rambling, stupid thing. And
Did you even do like the dubbing cassette to cassette?
I did some of that, yeah. And then I actually had a friend of the family who actually had a four-track recorder, and he was actually a musician, and we began to do some things with that. And so Dr. Demento played a few more things of mine, like over the course of the next few years. Like probably, I don't know, six or seven things over the next, like before I went to college or whatever. And then the best part was when he had his live show in L.A., He would have people there to like be his cast and like hang out. They'd answer the request lines and sort of make noise. Musical Mike, Whimsical Will, people
Whimsical
like that.
Will.
Sure. And then Dr. Demento was doing a autograph signing or a record signing at some record store in L.A. And so I went and met him. I was like, "Hey, I'm Eccentric Arrogant," and he was like, "Oh, hey," he knew who I was and remembered me or whatever. And I told him it would be awesome if I could come and like be one of those people at the show sometime, just like hang out, and wouldn't have to let me do anything, just like to hang out and watch. And he let me come and be one of the cast members. So I was there at the show.
I could listen to stories like that all day, and I don't just mean about like Dr. Demento, but just stories about people where it's, you know, like the thing that appeared like a beam from the heavens, and especially when it has some great sort of
it was very exciting,
American
to
graffiti esque,
exactly.
Sort of. I never got to do anything nearly that cool. I met him at Reed College a couple years ago because he went to Reed,
right?
And so he comes and he speaks every now and again, and I'm with him. And I'm like, oh, I grew up. I think you're awesome, and you're the reason I'm in radio. And the thing is, he's always so great in that he acts like that's not the billionth time that some pasty guy has come up going, "I think you're awesome, and I like funny songs," you know. And you know, he's always so. And he look. And the thing about Dr. Demento is, from the first moment I saw him, which is years and years and years ago, until he looks exactly like you want him to look.
Yeah.
He looks exactly.
He does
exactly like you think he looks.
And in real life, I can see why he went to radio, because he's very shy.
Yeah.
Like in person, in real life, he's very shy and reserved, not especially funny himself. He has a good sense of humor, obviously, but he's not a wild, crazy
but
guy.
But it's like we interviewed him here, and it was we pre-taped it. So so I called him, and he said hello, and I said, "Hey, this is Rick Emerson. We're going to be in the thing." He's like, "Okay, whatever." And so we exchanged. I made sure that I had the correct URL for his website and everything pre-prepared. And then I said, "Okay, here we go, and we're rolling." And I said, "Blah blah blah. Let's welcome now to the." And man, it was like. It was. He just turned it on, and immediately again with the woo 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 thing, and it just came out, and it was awesome.
He becomes Dr. Demento,
and it also it was interesting because this had to be like the gazillionth time he's done one of these phone interviews like this, and yet his enthusiasm sounded exactly the same. He didn't sound jaded at all.
And has for the 40 years he's been doing his show. He's great.
That's the best story. That's fantastic.
I get to call him Barry because, just pals.
What a final postscript to that. You mentioned the records that he used to send out.
Yeah.
So one of the great regrets of my life, and they are legion, is that. And this is just the shadow of your cool thing. But speaking of American Graffiti, I got a job at a radio station when I was around, I don't know, I was like 15 or so. I don't think I was actually even legal to work, but I got a job at a radio station. It was a top 40 station. And so I was busy like screaming into the mic like an idiot about, here's Mariah Carey or whatever. But across the hall was this automated AM station that ran Dr. Demento. And they would actually, the deal was they would send the Demento show on a record every week.
Right.
And it was for all the world. I felt like I was doing like the little like Wolfman Jack thing, where it's like, "Nah, I got these records, and I play them off these tapes, kid." And I would have to put the records on and put them on a reel to reel tape, and then it said on the records in big letters like "Must destroy after airing," and they were like these flimsy, like basically one shot vinyl records, and you were just supposed to use them and play them for that week, and then you were supposed to destroy them.
Right.
And I realized, like, later, it was like I was young and had no idea. I thought there was, like, it's like your permanent record in high school. I thought there was, like, some guy, some head of Dr. Demento record, enforcement that was going to come to the station. "Let me see the shredded pieces." And I realized I could have just kept all of those.
Yeah.
So that's kind of my Star Wars figure thing, is I didn't keep any of those syndicated shows that they've sent it, because they would all come in that format.
My thing like that, my in a very similar way, my first husband, his brother was working at the Los Angeles Times. I'm not sure what capacity, some backroom thing. And he started bringing us these things that had come off the teletype machine.
Yeah.
And it was Joe Bob Briggs' column, which the LA Times didn't run, but it was going out to every paper in the syndicate. And so Phil's brother David started reading these things that were coming off the teletype and going, oh my God, this is hilarious. And he brought a stack of them over. Nice. And we started reading them. And so then I got him to like bring them like every week because he wasn't in any of our papers in LA. But yeah, that's another thing where I think, why did we just throw those away after we read them? Why didn't I keep the teletype things?
You never, well, especially working in the, you know, they're working in media, you just sort of, you just get used to the idea that there's just hot and cold information coming in all the time. You know, it just runs constant 24 hours a day, and you're like, ah, there'll be more.
Once it's not today anymore, there's no use for it.
Yeah, I mean, the only things I think that I mean, I'm really a pack rat in terms of a lot of things, like, but I keep stuff that's like, I've kept a T-shirt from every radio station where I've worked. I have this whole crate in the basement of T-shirts that I will never wear. I mean, I'll never do anything with them. It's just, it's a thing that I keep, and you know, so I keep a lot of like radio sort of crap. But in terms of stuff like that, I think the only thing that I ever did is back when we had an AP wire, like the actual like the dot matrix printer that and it would just it was just like this sort of papyrus snake that would just, you know, it was just like it spit out, you know, information 24 hours a day. And occasionally if they would send a bulletin about like a celebrity snuffing it, I would take that. So I have like the one about the Sam Kinison getting killed. Which says, you know, urgent reports, blah, 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 same kind of stuff. I have the one about, I think, Tupac Shakur getting shot. And I have a bunch of that stuff. But it's, I don't think it's,
That was the Twitter of its day, really.
Well, and it's and a thing that, like, that you didn't just have access to, like, everywhere. It was a thing you had, you know, you had to basically work in a media outlet to have that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, these kids today.
All
right. Before we do the top five, we should actually talk just because it's your first time on the show, just a little bit about movies and stuff. So you write for film.com,
cinematical.com,
and I know you guys. Did you see? Was it last night? Did you see a screening, or was there a screening you guys went to, or you were going to go to?
I went to. Don didn't go for unknown reasons. I don't know why. I just got a text message saying I'm not going to be there. I believe it was related.
And you wrote me, and he responded via text saying, "You literally sicken me."
Fantastic.
Which is how I say I love you, and I'll miss you.
What was the film that Don failed to attend?
Hereafter, the new Clint Eastwood-directed thing with Matt Damon.
Which is, I don't know, does it have that, what do we, I think we're required to call it. Here's something you're required to say about Clint Eastwood films. It's a variation on something you're required to say about Elvis Costello records. For Elvis Costello records, they will always say, rewards repeated listens, which means that, like, you won't enjoy this, probably not for months. For Clint Eastwood films, though, they will say, unfolds, sometimes unspools, at a deliberate pace, which means that
it's very slow and boring. I've generally liked his movies, the last several of them, but this one didn't do it for me at all. So you didn't miss much, Don, okay. I don't think. I think you would have hated it more than me, actually.
Well,
I was picturing you next to me sighing exasperatedly and being upset with it.
As I'm wont to do.
Yeah.
Well, I don't like Clint Eastwood movies as a rule anyway.
And this one wouldn't convert you.
What do you mean when you don't? Well, hold on.
I don't care for him as a director.
I was going to say, on behalf of every listener everywhere, I have to ask for clarification. When you say you don't care for Clint Eastwood movies, you're meaning just those films he directs specifically?
Yeah. He's in.
The ones that he directs, and particularly just everything from like Unforgiven onward. I'm not a fan, and it's just his directing style. I just don't personally care for it. I'm not going to, you know, say that I think he's a bad director or that the movies themselves are bad. It's a taste thing. I just don't really care for him as a director.
Well, fair enough. But what happened at the screening?
Okay.
Rick may not know that there are a couple of giant women in motorized carts that always come to these screenings.
Are they like the twins in the Guinness Book of World Records?
No, they're not. They're not related. They're not connected to each other. Okay. They're two separate. I assume they're enemies, actually. I assume that they're in rival
supervillain
and one of these women I hate
Don
her.
Hates her a lot.
I loathe her.
Yeah. Let me just interrupt. Does Don misbehave at screenings, Eric Snyder?
She's usually pretty well behaved.
She doesn't have a lot of like truculent noises she makes during especially long films.
No.
He might be the wrong person to ask though, because he quacks during the musical.
If the music is jaunty, then I'll sort of sort of quack along with it.
Okay.
Yeah. Mostly to amuse Dawn.
But this one giant woman in her motorized cart, she would do these things where she would speed up and down the aisles, and she would say, like with her actual mouth. She would say beep beep,
yeah,
beep beep at people.
She would speak the words beep beep.
Yeah.
Yes,
that's like a guy. That's like that dick who stands in your doorway and goes knock knock.
Yeah,
you just want to pull out his teeth.
Except on top of everything else, then she's a big fat woman in one of those Mobi carts, and she's speeding around, and she just expects everyone to get out of her way, and she beeps at people.
So there's that woman, and there's also the other one who is older than her. And more oddly shapen and I think larger. Well, last night there was a third one.
No.
There was a third giant lady in a motorized cart. I think she's friends with the second one. Like she at the back of the theater, there's on either side, there's a place for either for wheelchairs or for giant carts full of fat people. And so there's really only room for two. And so now there was a third. So they had to like share a stall, a corral.
I'd also say I hate the beeping woman, not just because it has nothing to do with her being fat and being in like a motorized thing. It's her behavior with the saying beep and the buzzing around and insisting people get out of the way. And she sits in this corner in the back with a bunch of people who talk.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. See, that's enough. She's
just uncouth.
Is she a critic or is she just like
she's just one of the regular.
Like a screening pig?
Screening rat.
Yeah. All right.
So now there's a third one. And the third one, I think, is connected to the second one because they were near each other. I think they might have met. Maybe they're part of the same gang, part of the same giant motorized cart gang. But this third one, the first thing I noticed about her before I even noticed that she was 700 pounds in a giant cart was that her makeup she was painted up like a doll, like with red circles on her cheeks,
like I've written a letter to daddy kind of makeup.
Yeah, like at first I thought she was a man, like a transvestite, but she was clearly a woman, but her makeup was horrific and just altogether a train wreck.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you seize on the cosmetic application.
Well, that's how awful it was. That was the first thing I noticed about
it. It announced itself.
Yeah.
So you guys, I guess that I have to sort of recalibrate my image of this because you're talking about, you guys go to those screenings where it's like some jackass radio station has gone to like Lloyd Center.
Right.
And they're just going, hey, anybody who wants to go see something free. And then they just hand fistfuls of tickets to morons who show up.
A solid third of the audience are the people we refer to as the screening rats.
Yeah.
They
go to everything.
Who all know each other. They go to everything. They harass the people at Willamette Week or whoever has the
passes.
They
act like they own the place.
What do you have that's free?
Yeah.
And they act like this is just these screenings are just being presented for them.
Right.
No, I have to.
We also sometimes get actual just press screening where it's just for press.
See,
of course,
that's
we
the
prefer
thing.
Those.
I could totally see that because it's people who are there and are sort of taking the movie seriously.
There are some of those.
Whatever, but you know, because having you know, as a longtime radio employee, I know all too well the screenings where it's just like anybody who stopped at like a tile store, you know, and then they saw like a stack of things and they go, "What's this?" And the guy says, "Well, it's tickets for are they free?" Yes, sir. They're tickets for. All right, then. And he, you know, has a fistful, and then him and his various squalling children come along.
It could be a ticket pass for two to be punched in the balls. And if it's free, then we'll go. We'll wait in line for it. It's free.
Of course, the radio equivalent. It's funny that you call them screening rats. The radio equivalent is these people called prize pigs.
I've heard that.
By the way, there was, and I think it's been taken down, but there was at one point a Facebook page that had been put up, and it was some guy, and it wasn't sanctioned, obviously, but it was some Clear Channel employee in like Wichita or something. And because at radio stations, the people who have to deal with all the winners and the contest, you know, the folks and the prize pigs and the screener people, and it's the promotions team.
Right.
And usually, like, not even the promo director, but like low level, like promotions assistants. And they're the ones who go out to, like, hey, I'm broadcasting live from a parking lot outside a Mattress Warehouse, hating my life. Come by and get a free sticker. And people will just come by. People don't know who the radio station is. They don't know who you are. They don't listen to you. They could give a rip. But it's like the whole, are you going to be giving stuff away? And then they'll stand there in the sun, just sweating and stinking, waiting for the every 30-minute turning of the metal tumbler, after which you reach in and pull out a slip of paper, which will award them a Deuce Bigelow Frisbee. And they just stay there all day. So this guy at some Clear Channel station, he made like basically a share your prize pig stories Facebook page.
Nice.
He's like, for my radio brethren from coast to coast. Yeah. He's like, and the thing is, because every station has them. When I was doing that door-to-door thing where I was like knocking on doors and saying, thanks for coming by. At one point, Terry and I got out of the station vehicle. We go up to a house, and it had been pretty much just people who were Rick Emerson listeners or listeners to 970. But we got to the house, and I said, "Okay, what's this? What's the next house's name?" And she looked down and she said, "This is John, Lipinski or whatever." And then she stopped and she said, "Oh God!" And I said, "What?" And apparently it was just some KUFO prize pig who signed up for all of the station fan clubs, databases, mailing lists, whatever, because then he figures, more stuff for me.
Right.
And I said, well, who's that? And she goes, oh, God, he's like a KUFO prize pig. He's at all the remotes, all the events, him and his whole freaking family. And I said, okay, well, it can't be that meant. She said, no, it is. So we knock on the door, and he sees the KUFO shirt that Terry's wearing and the CBS shirt that I'm wearing, and he immediately figures, I've won something. It's like the best day of his life, right? It's like the giveaway has come to him. So we go into his house, and I swear to God, every conceivable item that he owned, he had won from a radio station. It was like every I expected his children to be tattooed with like Jammin' 107.5 logos. So everything he owned, he had won, I think, from a radio station of some kind.
Yeah, the screening red equivalent of that is the people that we just keep seeing. We see at every single screening, and they're wearing T-shirts from previous screenings.
Right.
Our favorite, the guy, it was a kid's movie.
It was a kid's movie, and he was wearing a shirt that he had gotten from Kinsey, the sex movie.
And it said, let's talk about sex.
Yeah, awesome. That's the shirt he was wearing at like Shrek 3 or something.
And he was huge and hairy.
Of course he was, yeah.
And it was horrible.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Good times.
It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. In just one moment, we will get underway with today's Top 5. It is the Top 5 songs inspired by and taking their titles from horror films. That is something put together by Dawn Taylor. We'll get to that in mere moments. Join us tomorrow, by the way, when Kelly Clark from Willamette Week will be here. And don't forget, you got, so today's Tuesday the 19th, so Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So you got till Monday the 25th. So you got like whatever that is, 6 days, 5 days, something. You got till the end of Monday the 25th, till 11:59 p.m. Monday the 25th to get your submissions for the Geeko Lantern contest in. And so if you haven't seen those, you go to rickemerson.com/pictures. You can see up to and including the Geeko Lantern, which is where listener Melody has carved a representation of Dawn's femur back when it was still intact, before they sawed bits of your body away,
yeah.
Sort of Anakin style.
I've never had anybody carve an homage to any of my body parts onto a pumpkin before.
Have you seen the, you don't even know what I'm talking about.
She showed me the picture before, yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
Do you know the thing with Dawn's femur?
Well, I don't think I know that story, and
I swear to God.
I must. When did this happen?
Well,
when I had
my hip replaced.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, and they cut the femur ball off, and I kept it.
I guess
in a
I didn't
cut.
Realize that you got to keep the femur ball.
I'm surprised you didn't know that.
Why have you never shown me your bone?
I don't know.
I showed you mine.
And so there was this weirdness about a month ago where Dawn shows up and she said, "So I was boiling my femur bone last night," which is like strumming the ukulele.
Were you making a stock? Like for a soup or something?
It was in the freezer, and I went, you know, I've never cleaned this up, because I had it in the freezer because it still, you know, had meat attached, and I didn't want it to go bad.
Oh.
Did you feel like keeping part of the gristle or whatever just so you could clone yourself in the future? You know, just to maybe make a little, you know, give yourself stem cells or something?
Originally, when it was still fresh, I was going to boil it up and
clean it. When it was still fresh, when it hadn't gone gamey.
And I was going to actually, like, eat a little piece of it so I could say I had eaten human flesh.
My stem cells have gotten freezer burn.
Why didn't you do that?
Well, because by the time I got around to cleaning it, it had been in the freezer for like 4 years.
Oh, man.
And it smelled awful,
by the way,
when I boiled it down. Well, it just smelled really bad.
Nobody wants to be the one to tell you, Dawn, but I I like the idea that you would actually consume bits of your own, and not just bits of your own body, but like stuff that God didn't mean for you to ever see. Like, he hid that away inside, but that it's just, the smell was off-putting. It was not so much the notion.
I think it's because it had been in, you know, it had been in the freezer for a very long time.
But if it hadn't smelled bad, you would have eaten it.
Did you put it in a freezer bag, Dawn? Because if you just use a regular Ziploc bag, no, so you can't.
It was just in the little specimen cup thing that gave it to me.
Those aren't made for sub-zero temperatures. No, baby, you gotta do the yellow and blue make green thing. You gotta get the double ply for that.
The freezer, and anyone who knows anything about food service will tell you, the freezer is not like, you know, a suspended animation chamber. It's like, you know, bacteria still continues to grow and things go bad even in the freezer.
Sure.
It just slows them down a lot.
Well.
So, you know.
Next time you get a hunk of yourself.
I will. When I get my knee replaced.
I was going to ask, are they going to replace anything else in your apparently obsolete body?
At some time in the foreseeable future, I'll be getting a full knee replacement. Ooh. So I'll have more parts, and
now,
maybe we'll make a fine little stew.
Now does the knee, I know I sound like an idiot here, but I am what I am.
The knee bone's connected to the shin bone.
But is there a knee bone, or is it just cartilage?
No, there are your patella is a bone, the kneecap, And then when they to do a complete knee replacement, basically they're going to like carve off essentially both the top and the bottom of both the leg bones.
So there is some bone involved here, because I don't want it to be a thing where it just goes on that biohazard chute, because they just burn that. They waste it.
No, they're basically going to take apart the entire knee and then put in all new parts.
Awesome. All right.
Dawn 2.0 will be fantastic.
I know.
Pretty soon you're just going to be hulking around in a huge metal exoskeleton.
That's my dream.
On a, you know, in a spaceship and just sort of, you are in violation of, you have 10 seconds to comply. That started off as a Jason X thing and it became a RoboCop thing like halfway through. I don't know where that happened. So this whole discussion of, I swear to God, Dawn boiling bits of her own body on the stove and then deciding it was too rank to eat. Brought to you by The Cleaning Solution. Mr. Michael Beatty is the proprietor of that fine company, and he rues the day that he became an advertiser on the Emerson News Network. He laments his poor choices, and he wishes only for some sort of affordable and efficient time travel so that he might go back and warn his past self against this business alliance, which has not turned out at all the way he expected. But it's too late for him. So I will simply tell you that The Cleaning Solution, they are right here in Portland, Oregon, and they are a local business. I don't just mean they operate here. I mean, he buys his supplies, his accessories, all of that stuff from other Portland businesses, and he keeps his money right here at the Emerson News Network. For anything your feet might trot upon in your home, whether it's your carpet or tile, stone, the flagstones, the walkway, entryway, if you're just schlepping in a bunch of dirt during the summer or snow during the winter or mud in all the time in between, you can make sure that all of the walkways and the surfaces in your home or your upholstery, anything like that, can look as good as the day you got it. And if you just let it go, which, let's be, the odds are like one in one that you have, like me, you just wake up one day and you go, this is filthy. You can actually get it, clean, so it's going to look, just the way it was. You got to put in there. He'll get you on a maintenance program so that you don't have to worry about, having some huge, massive cleaning job done every year and a half. You'll just keep it looking fantastic.
Can they take the stain out of one rug and put it into another rug?
Like to a hated enemy?
Yeah.
Like if you could just sort of carry it around in a little right. valise in your pocket,
or
probably.
Maybe the stain would look nice in this other carpet in the other room, just not where it is.
It would fit in really well with the shag somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's entirely possible, because you figure, because the conservation of mass is such that matter cannot be destroyed, only changed in terms of its appearance.
True.
So he could probably remove it and give it to you like as an extract.
It's worth asking.
Maybe. Maybe that could be a side business, sort of a it could be
stain
like the,
transference.
Well, it could be like the fake vomit of the new millennium or something. You contact him at 971-533-3211. Don't ask him about the vomit. 533-3211. 971-533-3211. Mr. Michael Beatty, he owns and operates The Cleaning Solution, and it's The Cleaning Solution. 971-533-3211. Here is your
fire.
Top five for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
Counting is wonderful. Counting is marvelous. Counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness. Counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
It is the Rick Emerson radio show. This is Don Taylor's top five. These are the... How long did it take you to put this together, by the way? From concept to execution.
I'd have to say a good hour or so, because once I started, I thought it would be easy, and then I, like I said, I realized I didn't know how many songs there were.
Many.
That were inspired by horror movies. So I basically then narrowed it down to, I decided to just go with songs that the title of the song was also referencing the film itself. A couple of them are a little bit more science fiction-y than necessarily straight horror, but I did stick to my whole thing of... The titles are the movie that they're referencing.
All right. So these are Don Taylor's top five songs that are based upon and take their title from a horror film. What is our honorable mention today, Don
Taylor? Our honorable mention is the Edgar Winter Group, Frankenstein. And this is actually, I think, the reason, a really good illustration of why there's an honorable mention on this list, on this your top five content. Because I don't really like this song
very
much.
But you have to do it.
But it has to be on the list.
Yeah, if you know there's some guy in a ponytail that'll charge you, after the show, and
But as a staple of rock radio for so many years, I could happily never listen to this song again. But
this is sort of like this song is like a kind of a freeze-dried ice cream, in that you know, the freeze-dried ice cream is the thing where you know, they've just reduced it. Like, they've removed the water and the whatever, and so it's like the same amount of ice cream, but condensed into a tiny, tiny little cube. I could just hear the opening riff of this song, and I've heard it so many goddamn times over the years that I could just play the entire thing in my head. I don't actually even need to listen to it anymore. Just one drop and the entire thing just sort of unspools inside my head.
Ugh. It sounded better when it was actually in the original Frankenstein movie, 1931.
Yeah. It was fresher then.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just trying to imagine. I mean, I guess that there was, you know, I guess there was some halcyon time when people heard this, but this is awesome. This is the best new song I've heard.
Smoked, yeah.
Maybe if I were high, you know, like ever, this would...
if you're high in, like, 1971.
I think it also has to be the 70s. Yeah.
This is the thing where it just sounds like he's playing with his elbows, right? You know, it's like he's just decided to hit the keyboard with his forehead a lot.
Why are we still listening to it?
I have no idea.
Is this what they call prog rock?
No. It's not bad enough to be prog rock.
Yeah.
And it's only in one part. It's not in nine parts over five album sides that no one wants to listen to.
It doesn't keep changing meters, like 4-4, 5-4, 3-4.
And there isn't some, and you know, and again, there isn't some guy standing outside in like, you know, in like the Three Wolf Moon shirt lecturing you about why it's better than whatever's in your record collection. And Frank Zappa's a genius. All right. These are the top five songs based upon and taking their titles from a horror film.
Number five, Anvil, Mothra.
Okay, I have to tell you, I didn't even know the song existed.
Neither do I.
So well done.
Thank you.
I like what I've heard so far. Plus, like, who writes songs about Mothra?
Anvil, I have to admit, I never even heard of Anvil until the documentary.
Me too.
And now I love Anvil.
First, I thought the documentary was a mockumentary. I thought it was like Spinal Tap, like a made-up band. But they're apparently real.
I interviewed one of the guys, I don't remember who. What's the one guy's name? Hot Lips or something Lips. It wasn't him, it was the other guy. And I interviewed him last year, and I don't know if he was high or just if he was asleep or if it was like the millionth interview he'd done. But it was one of those things where you'd ask him the question, and it was almost like it was being translated at the UN. Or you then put on a satellite phone to Qatar. You had to wait for him to come back. I think I got like nine words out of him the entire time. But then I saw him like in a video for this, and it's like, you know, they just... And is it just the two guys, or is it like... Is there like an actual band along with them?
No, there is an actual band.
Yeah, I think it's two main guys that have always been there, and then I think various drummers or something.
So I don't know. They're the Ann and Nancy Wilson of Anvil.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mothra.
Have you seen that documentary? Anvil? Story of Anvil?
I think so. Or it's possible that I heard so much about it that I feel like I've seen it.
It's a fun documentary.
Okay, that's pretty great. That's really great.
They're Canadian, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of has a, I don't know, like not quite as good as Dio or much better than Grim Reaper feel to it somehow.
Yeah, the thing about coming up with songs for with horror movie homages, if you're willing to get into that really like annoying death metal crap, there's a lot of them.
Oh yeah, I'll
these bet. Bands with these songs like you know the Grave Robbers and the Casket Bleeders and the Devil Dolls.
Casket Bleeders.
Here, this is Anvil with Mothra. These are the top five songs that are based upon and take their title from a horror film.
Number four, The Misfits, Them.
Mm. Now, here's the thing I'm going to say.
Uh-huh.
And I know that I'm just, I don't know, I'm losing all my, I don't know, all my punk experience points are diminishing or whatever. I don't really know that much about the Misfits. Mm. I know that I'm supposed to say that they're awesome, and blah, 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 Fiend Club, blah, 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 only played on Halloween, blah, 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 forerunners of today's metal. And I'm not saying that any of that stuff's untrue. Yeah. It's probably not. But it's just one of those things that I always heard about the Misfits growing up because, like, the guys in Metallica talked about them relentlessly. Yeah. They were name-checked so often. But just, you know, in the pre-internet era and in my hometown especially, which is a tiny town. It was like that little Footloose town where there was, like, no rock to be had. And there was, like, a Sam Goody, basically. That was like, all there was for music. There was just nowhere to actually hear it. And so I missed the window of time Like, I never, by the time I heard The Misfits, it was past the early formative stages, and I feel like they never resonated with me the way they would have if I'd heard them as a teenager.
I was never a fan of The Misfits. I will tell you, the reason they're on this list for me is because when you get to the chorus, they sing about exoskeletons. You don't hear the word exoskeleton in songs nearly enough.
Because them was the one about the giant ants, right?
Right.
Yeah.
May have missed the part about the exoskeletons.
Man-made monsters.
By the way, I think maybe he's reading a like something other than the King James version. I'm not entirely sure that the Bible prophecy. That's a radical revision of the text.
Yeah, I think I caught that too.
You don't remember the part about the giant ants the nuclear war?
No, I must have missed that. That's
nuclear war may be implied in Revelation, but I don't. Giant ants, I don't think is in there.
I have to say, by the way, that them is which I haven't seen in maybe I don't know, probably 4 or 5 years. It seems like the last time I saw it, I remember thinking that it actually held up really well.
Yeah.
And it's a legitimately freaky movie. It scared the hell out of me when I was a kid. It was another one of those things that I saw late in the afternoon when I was like 7. And there's that sequence where the girl has gone into catatonic shock, like Newt style, because the ants killed her family, and he holds like the prussic acid or whatever it is in a glass underneath her nose because it's like the trail that ants leave, and then she freaks out all over again. And then the ants make that weird, like high-pitched chirping sound, which is really freaky. If anybody that hasn't seen the movie Them with an exclamation mark, it's quite good.
Yeah, watch that in a double feature with Phase 4, and you'll just be freaked out by ants like forever.
What is that? I think it's actually just called Ants. It's the one with Suzanne Summers.
I thought that was the one with Joan Collins.
There's also one called Kingdom of the Ants.
Oh, maybe that's
no.
The one
you're thinking
Joan
of Kingdom
Collins.
Of the Spiders.
There's.
Oh God!
There is a kingdom of the spiders. I want to say. I think there's a kingdom of there's something of the ants. Empire of the ants.
Empire
of the ants.
Yeah, Empire of the ants and Kingdom of the Spiders.
Right.
Two different films. Yeah. So one Joan Collins, the other William Shatner.
Right.
Yes. Weird gearlock there for a second. the one I'm thinking of is there's a movie called Ants, and it's the same. It's like Soylent Green is people. Ants is Piranha. Is Jaws. It's the whole we got to open this brand new condos on the lake. But what about the ants? Forget the ants. We got to make money. Blah blah blah. And the whole movie exists for this one sequence, which I can only imagine was done at the behest of the director, who I think had some sort of weird insect fetish, because there is a sequence where Suzanne Summers, having had the sex. She like is dozing off while her man is in the shower. He's scrubbing away the sin, and she goes to sleep in the bed. And then the ants, of course, start streaming in like the sliding glass door or whatever that's in their hotel room that is adjacent to the hotel. And then she is covered with ants. She's nude, and then she actually just—I don't think you actually see any nudity, but it's that thing of it's actually kind of effective where she's covered up to the neck with the sheet and she's sleeping. But then it's just that thing of like you see the ants streaming into the bed. But they're going under the sheets, so you don't really see them. And then the sheets are like to that rustling thing. And then she throws, she kind of throws back the sheet, and they cut it so you don't see any nudity. But she's basically just like covered with ants.
Wow.
And so it's like hot chick, big rack covered in ants. And at that point, the director was like, "This is my masterwork." So it really is worth
that seeing. Is a very specific demographic interested in the hot naked chick covered in ants.
Well, it was an earlier time. There was no Usenet, so you had to get your message out in other ways. These are the top five songs based on and taking their titles from a horror film. Don Taylor.
Number 3, Iron Maiden, Phantom of the Opera.
The existence of this song seems inevitable somehow.
Yeah. Well, they consider this like their masterwork. They play this live, apparently, and fans insist that they play it, and they feel like this is the entire existence for our band, is to play this song.
This is from when Michael Crawford was in the band.
Right. This was the Andrew Lloyd Webber years of Iron Maiden.
Is that the quacking you were...
Yeah.
Usually it's a little slower.
Yeah, it's
than
not usually
that,
speed metal.
I forgot. Here's the thing about prog metal is we could probably go to lunch and come back and get a good like siesta in. Oh, there we go. Finally.
Yeah.
And at some point, this will be about the Phantom of the Opera.
It's hard to tell because I can't really tell what he's singing.
Yeah.
They say that it's about Phantom of the Opera.
They would know.
I should probably have the Misfits higher than Iron Maiden. Mm. If I had this to do over, I would swap those out.
So you say that, and that's the sort of thing that'll get you excoriated by the...
I tell you, the ordering is difficult in these top fives.
That's the thing. It's always number two, and what is the number one? Because there's always a contingent of the audience that feels that they ought to be swapped.
Oh, yeah, and I'm going to take crap on this one for my position.
The Maiden
number
thing,
two and number one.
I gotta tell you, like 80% of the complaints I've received about top fives over the years, they have to do with either Iron Maiden or Slayer. You know, and the Iron Maiden guys, always write these really long, very well thought out, very well crafted, well constructed arguments.
Like frog emails.
Yeah, like filled with profanity, but still really, really, like the syntax is all correct. And, you know, these really like, you know, making their point with, you know, bringing it into stark relief with a certain written kind of verbal dexterity, a linguistic flair. And the Slayer guys, it's like they always just, you know, you bad, I kill, drink blood, die, 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 Slayer. And then like a doll's head enclosed or something. Is this still the same?
This is the same damn song. It just goes on forever. Much like the Phantom of the Opera Andrew Lloyd Webber movie. They're actually kind of is fitting, really, if you think about it.
Can I tell you that I have actually never seen the Phantom of the Opera in any of its iterations?
Really?
I have no, which is just like, it's not like I'm opposed to it. It's just like it never, I don't know, I guess I never had the opportunity or never sought it out, and so it didn't come across my transom, and so I didn't see it.
The Lon Chaney film is terrific.
Well, no, I should say that, I mean, I've seen that.
Okay.
But I'm talking about the
musical.
The Andrew Lloyd Webber thing.
When they made the movie, which was directed by Joel Schumacher, my husband insisted on going to see it because he just knew it was going to be a terrible train wreck, but also that many of the ladies that he talks to every day while he drives around to dentist offices and deals with all of the dental technicians and receptionists all day, that they were curious to hear about it. So we went, and we made it halfway through before I just went, I'm leaving, and I'm leaving you here. And he's like, no, it's okay, we can go now. But yeah, apparently what I got from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera was that it is about a woman who basically will fall in love with whichever guy sings at her the loudest.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like whatever guy is in front of her singing, love me, here's a rose, you know, then she goes, okay, I love you now.
Is that not how it works?
That hasn't been my personal experience, but I am not every woman.
Well, true.
Unlike Oprah.
All right, I think we have a little bit of breaking news we're going to get to here in just one
second.
Ooh,
I like breaking news.
I will endeavor to find that here. I'll get some information on that as we do this top five. These are the top five songs inspired by, taking their titles from horror films. Don Taylor, we're ending that. What is next?
Number two is Blue Oyster Cult, Godzilla. Now this, as opposed to Frankenstein, I will say, I have never been a Blue Oyster Cult fan, but I love this song. Because it's so literal.
Yeah, I like that.
That it's not, Godzilla isn't a metaphor for anything in this song.
It's a giant monster tearing the high-tension wires down.
Thinking about what Godzilla's doing.
Yeah. Eating Japanese folk.
Right.
Hey, did you see on, one of the cool features they've started doing on Ain't It Cool, not to plug a competitor, but they do this thing, they're doing like a behind-the-scenes picture of the day or of the week or whatever. And it's just, you know, it's just some like candid still photo taken on the set of whatever film. But they actually had a shot from, I think, I don't know if it was the original Godzilla or one of the early Godzilla films, but they were, where a guy was like I don't think it was an actual, it wasn't an actual take. I think the guy was practicing. It was the guy in the suit practicing his eventual kicking over of, like, Tokyo. And it was like, the suit was only half on. Because I always figured it was, like, zipped up the back and it was whatever.
Right.
But it was like the horse costume at the party. It was like a top half, bottom half. And so he basically just had, like, Godzilla pants on. It was like hip waders, but they were Godzilla. And he was, like, clearly, like, looking and calculating, like, how to stomp and how to kick over this building properly. And, like, you never see the guy in just part of the costume. Yeah. And he had these, like, suspender straps that went over his shoulders that, like, held up the Godzilla bottoms.
Well, there's probably a couple of different suits. There's probably just, from the waist down, four shots of Godzilla's feet and legs stomping.
That probably is true.
And
that's
then
probably true.
A full suit for full Godzilla body shots.
True.
I wonder if it was the same guy all the time in the Godzilla suit.
Actually, it was for a long time. I think eventually he finally died, but because they first made the first Godzilla movie, you know, in the 50s.
Yeah, something.
And it was the same guy who played Godzilla all the way up into the 70s.
Like Big Bird. Like Big Bird. Always been the same guy. It is the same guy, actually.
Carol
Big Bird
Spinney.
And Godzilla. Yeah. Carol Spinney is Godzilla.
How great would that be just to see Big Bird kicking over a city?
Carol Spinney in his Godzilla pants.
Making that sort of weird... I can't do the... I'm sorry, I failed on the noise there. Wow.
Something like that.
Okay. Normally I could do... There was one of those things
that was more of a Ghidra noise, really.
No.
My throat was a little dry there and I failed. Normally I could do the Godzilla thing. But yeah, but just, you know, and look up and just... No! Just, you know, Big Bird just sort of stomping on a
town. That'd be awesome.
So you want to do the number one and then do the breaking news, or do you want to do the breaking news?
Yeah, I'm going to... are you online? You are online. I'm going to send you a link.
Okay.
All right.
Do you want to hand me the link and I'll hand it to her?
No, it's...
Are you sending it to my email?
Here's the thing. I'll circle the headline here. You just go to CNN and look that up. That's the story. I don't know why it's printing the last page first. So we'll do that. We'll do that breaking news here in just 1 second. Oh, here we go. Don Taylor, I've got it. It's printing. It's printing this story up backwards. So I'm getting the comments page first.
Oh yeah, you never print all of the CNN stories.
So we'll get to that here in just 1 second. These are the top five songs inspired by or taking their name from a horror film. Don Taylor.
Number one, The Ramones, Pet Sematary.
Well done.
Ah.
I love this song, by the way. I'm a huge Ramones fan, so it kind of goes without saying that I would like this. But I mean, even judging on the curve of already being a Ramones fan, this is really, it's a singular work.
It is.
And also, it's proved, I mean, I love the Ramones. I really do. And I know that despite sort of with the reflexive punk purist belief it would have people sort of assume, the Ramones really craved mainstream crossover success, like, for their entire career. I mean, they did everything they possibly could to try to have actual, real, like, top 40 songs. I mean, they didn't want to be, like, a niche act or a cult act. I mean, they really did everything they could think of to try to sell lots of records. And to, as Joey Ramone said, he's like, we tried to sell out over and over again. He's just like, nobody was buying. But this is almost proof of why... For good and bad, this is why they couldn't do it.
Because if they're doing a song called Pet Sematary...
Yeah, it's like you listen to the song and the production for a Ramon song is pretty tame. It's catchy.
Yeah.
It's the guitars are mixed down. It's got keyboards and like a glockenspiel thing happening. And it's a sort of pretty song in the sense that it's not like aggro sounding. But yeah, it's about a pet cemetery.
Right.
Yeah. And that's just not going to work.
It is about Stephen King's Pet Sematary.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again.
Sure.
Yeah, no.
Those are universal themes, though.
Who hasn't felt this way?
Yeah.
And really, I'm not saying only the Ramones could do this, but of all the bands to actually sing the chorus, like, straight-facedly, I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery. It's really hard to think of anybody else who could do it as well as the Ramones did. It's like it's a real concern, like something that sort of that was nagging
that
at
weighs
him.
On their minds.
Yeah, so, like he was.
In case it comes up, I just want you to know.
It's like his own living will, you know? It's like the Joey Ramone do not resuscitate order, do not inter in Pet Cemetery.
Well, you know, my husband and I had that discussion about like, you know, we have actually agreed, you know, after death, neither one of us is allowed to bury the other one in a pet cemetery.
Well,
in the hopes of reanimating our corpse. We've actually had that discussion.
Have it tattooed on your stomach. That's the only way to be sure.
Those medical alert bracelets.
All right, that is your top five. Your top five songs inspired by and taking their title from horror films. Before we wrap it up for the day, we should do this. Here is Don Taylor with a little bit of breaking news.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
We actually have a breaking or supplemental snuff watch.
Here is your breaking news. It is your snuff watch for Tuesday right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Here is Don Taylor, ladies and gentlefolk.
Happy Days, Dad. Tom Bosley died of heart failure today after a battle with lung cancer.
Tom Bosley.
He was 83. Bosley's 50 years as a television actor included roles on dozens of shows, but he was best known as Howard Cunningham, the patriarch of the 1950s Happy Days family, a show that aired for 11 seasons starting in 1974. Ron Howard, who played his son Richie, said, "Remarkable on so many levels, Tom's insight, talent, strength of character, and comic timing made him a vital central figure in the Happy Days experience. A great father and husband and a wonderful artist, Tom led by example and made us all laugh while he was doing it." Henry Winkler, who was the Fonz on Happy Days, said Bosley was a family member both on and off the soundstage. "We acted together, traveled together, and played charades together. He was a loving husband, a doting father, and a fantastic grandfather."
One of those things is not like the other. That's an oddly specific memory to have. I mean, hey, whatever. But
we acted together. We played charades.
We used our Vitamixes at the same time. Was he did the Father Dowling Mysteries thing too? Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Isn't that his thing? Because that's where like the 50s and 60s guys not go to die, but where they go to live on
Van Dyke. Good one.
Mm-hmm. And Andy Griffith. With Matlock.
Right.
So he was 83.
Yes.
I guess I didn't think he was already dead, but it does surprise me that he was only 83. I would have pegged him as being older than that.
You want to know what? He would have been 2 years younger than Paul Newman. He was, because Bosley was born in 1927 and Paul Newman was born in 25. But it's weird because you think of them as being entirely opposite ages.
Yeah, you really do. Tom Bosley's one of those guys that, like, you know, if you grew up like I did with a father who was just, you know, not really all that great, you would watch something like Happy Days and just go, man, Tom Bosley would be the best dad.
Can I just show you this? We could probably just spend years asking people, just canvassing people to ask which sitcom parent they wish was their real parent. Eric Snyder?
It's right now. It's hard for me to think of a better one than him.
Seriously, how
Mr. Cunningham?
I mean, you know,
because he was still frisky, because also that means that you'd have Mrs. Cunningham as your mom,
and had his, you know, and the thing is, he was married, had his own life and interests, because he would. What was the thing? It wasn't the. It wasn't like the Water Buffalo Club. What was the organization he belonged to?
Oh,
where he wore like a fez or some crap.
Yeah,
and it was fake. Like, it wasn't the Shriners, but it was like.
Right.
It was like the Loyal Order of, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Something, yeah.
But he got frustrated and, you know, and had to deal with all of the shenanigans of Richie and his pals. But at the same time, he was not unreasonable. He was not.
He was a warm, loving father.
He was.
You know, I heard something. This is actually not about Tom Bosley, but just about the whole thing of sitcom parents. So our friend Seamus, who is, you know, it's a guy who, for whatever reason, I don't know why this is, but he has little strange pockets of pop culture. I don't say ignorance, but just things that he didn't see the first time around. There's little gaps in his pop culture knowledge that he sort of is trying to make up for now by just power loading things into his brain. And he said he realized last year that just inexplicably he had never seen The Brady Bunch, which is just like a weird, like you almost have to hide out in the mountains, you know, in sections of America, you know, just to not see The Brady Bunch. But he'd never seen it. And he was only the second person under the age of like 50 in my life that I had ever met who had not ever seen The Brady Bunch. The other person who seen The Brady Bunch was a girl that I knew in Clearfield, Utah, actually, who didn't own a television. So, she was sort of like she, you know, she gets a pass.
Probably a lot of stuff she didn't know.
Exactly. But Rick Emerson was happy to
teach
her.
We were on the moon? When did we go to the moon?
I'm glad you said that over the creepy thing that I just said. I'm glad that happened, actually. I regretted that as soon as it was out of my mouth.
I just try to just keep moving when you say creepy things like that. Just keep going down that highway.
I appreciate that.
Driving the bus.
So he decided to catch up on the Brady Bunch. And so he sent me this long email, and it was like at 3 in the morning or something. And he said, you know, he's like, I'm halfway through second season of Brady Bunch. He turned into Bridget Jones, apparently. I'm moving through V fast. We'll try to finish by end of weekend. But he said something that I hadn't really ever thought about, which kind of goes back to the Tom Bosley, Mr. Cunningham thing. He said that he was growing up on sitcoms from the 80s. He said he was really surprised when he watched The Brady Bunch. And he said, lo and behold, here's a sitcom dad who is not an idiot or a bumbler or a boob or a fool who doesn't always have the answers, but doesn't like make a hopeless mess of things when he doesn't, actually is warm and intelligent and cares about his children, and doesn't appear to be some sort of comedic passive danger to his family all the time.
And not being walked all over by his shrew of a better-looking wife.
Yeah, right. That he was actually, he was like a guy who you would really want as your parent, who was idealized, but was in some ways closer to reality than the sort of King of Queens, model, which is just, which is just stamped out of, a stencil that has been spray painted so many times now that it doesn't even exist anymore.
I guess that's a fairly recent innovation that the sitcom dads have turned like that.
And so when did that happen? Like
in the 80s it was still Cliff Huxtable and the guy from Growing Pains.
Well, in the early 90s with Roseanne, John Goodman's character was a full partner and was not a boob and a bundler.
Yeah.
It
like
was the
a
whole room, everybody like a, loves Raymond.
Like a married with children kind of a thing?
Yeah. Maybe, but it seemed to come along with Everybody Loves Raymond and King of Queens. And Yes, Dear. That whole weird little clot of stand-up comics getting...
It just became Fat Guy, Hot Wife.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that is a strange. It's a strange thing when you go back and you watch that. And even as much as I didn't really care for the Cosby Show at the time, that was just such a world apart from all of those shows you just mentioned. And of course, Roseanne was, I think, for a large section of its run was the gold standard, for families that you could actually that you wouldn't mind having and that you could conceivably picture yourself being part of. I had some other point I was going to make here. Oh, except my sitcom parent is Esther Rolle from Good Times. So because it looked like she could, like, even in your gloomiest moments, she could just sort of hold you to her ample bosom. And just give you sort of like a, it'll be all right, baby. And then you would just go like, you'd exhale and just
John
feel
Amos
good about
would
them.
Also have been a good dad. Although you just always wondered why he didn't just pound JJ into dust.
Right. And then didn't he leave for the last season?
Yeah, they killed him off, though, in a car crash.
Is that what it was?
He wanted more money, I think. And so the Good Times producers killed him off. That's how you know that you have really pissed off the producers, like Valerie Hogan style. I want more money. Yeah, your character's dead, McLean Stevenson. F you. Yeah. And that's you're never coming back.
Especially when the show is called Good Times. Good Times. You're dead. You want more money? You're out.
It's an ironic kind of good time. So John Amos, they killed his character off via a car accident because I think it was that he wanted more money. And he's one of those guys that just like sank without a trace. Like, forever until then he surfaced on the West Wing as one of the he was like the he was the I want to say Minister of Defense, but that's the British, but he was like one of the Joint Chiefs or whatever.
Like to think that he was like in New York doing stage work during that, because he was a serious well-respected actor before Good Times,
and he showed up at the end of 30 Rock a couple weeks ago.
That's right, he did.
A little cameo at the end of 30 Rock.
See, I dig it when those guys they make their way back out of the wilderness.
Yeah,
as opposed to J.J. Walker, who just it's like some sort of a show business barnacle.
And
just sort of,
rightfully so, though.
Did I ever tell you at the time that I interviewed J.J. Walker? And it's like he has his people talk to you beforehand. They give you a pre. And this is like in 1996. I mean, like way past the point of anybody really caring. And I had to go through two publicists, not just to book the interview, but like the day of the interview. The interviewer, was screened by two publicists, both of whom told me, And it was always Mr. Walker. Like, do not ask Mr. Walker about Good Times. Do not ask Mr. Walker to say Dynamite.
What else would you ask him?
Nothing. Nothing. That the answer to that, nothing, Eric. Wow. Zero. Nada. Zilch.
Yeah, it's like you know, if you're interviewing Dustin Diamond and all you're allowed to ask him is about his porn tape.
Yeah. No.
Or Tom Bosley about his.
Yeah.
So there you go. Tom Bosley, dead. There's your snuff watch for Tuesday. Eric Snyder, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a delight.
You have to come back at some point.
I would love that. Can I plug a thing?
Absolutely.
I remembered a thing that I should plug. Is over on Cascadia.fm on Fridays, Movie BS with Bayer and Snyder.
That's right.
Jeff Bayer and I talk about movies for an hour. In fact, we're on right before Legion of News on Fridays.
11 a.m.
Yeah, we're wedged between Court and Fatboy and Legion of News.
It's where everybody wants to be.
Exactly. It's a nice sandwich to be in.
We're sort of the Esther Roll of John Amos.
We're in the Veronica's Closet time slot, like between Friends and Seinfeld.
Awesome.
People keep listening just because, you know, we're there.
Eric D. Snyder can be heard Fridays 11 a.m. To noon at Cascadia.fm and read at film.com or cinematical.com. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Ms. Kelly Clark from Willamette Week. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milk Packing District here in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Agler, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa, and so forth. The Rick Emerson Show made possible today and every day by a generous grant from you, my friends. It is Tuesday, October 19th, 2010, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, as always, thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.